Microphones are live.
Thank you, Madam Clerk, and welcome everybody to the August 12th meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. If you do need some assistance hearing proceedings in chambers today, we do have hearing assist devices stored at each end of the dais. And with that, if you would please all rise and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Madam Clerk, to my knowledge, we have no changes to today's agenda. Do you concur?
I concur.
Thank you, ma'am. With that, we come to our consent agenda. I do have a few requests to speak. We'll start with Nikki Schmidt, followed by Eric Greening.
Good morning. I am Nikki Schmidt at the County Administrative Office. I am here to talk about item number 6. In my excitement to get it into agenda.net, I neglected to attach attachment 1 and 2 to the auditor's response letter. I have passed that out to each one of you and to the clerk, and I apologize for the error.
Not to worry. Thank you, Ms. Schmidt. Mr. Greening, followed by Diana Haynes.
Thank you. Good morning. I am Eric Greening on agenda item 3. This is an amendment to the agreement with the Ferguson Group on their federal lobbying. I notice a distinct difference in emphasis on how this board makes use of the services of our Sacramento lobbyists versus our Washington lobbyists. The Sacramento lobbyists are big-time policy wonks and return with very detailed reports on all sorts of legislation, on all sorts of policy matters. With the Ferguson Group, that part of it is very, very lightly handled in general, and the main purpose of the Ferguson Group, in your minds, seems to be getting as much federal funding into this county as possible. I could use the term pork, but, you know, some of it is for very good purposes. I'm not objecting to the concept that all taxpayers nationwide contribute to the federal pot, and any jurisdiction should get its share out of that same pot once it's been through whatever sausage factory is happening in Washington. But it does seem that opportunities to engage on issues of policy that are not exactly fiscal have been slighted with the Ferguson Group. And I'm wondering if in the process of deciding how and whether to continue to use their services, you need to have a discussion about that. Are they capable of the same level of policy engagement as the Sacramento lobbyists and just not being asked to do it? Or what's the story here? Just as an example of a policy level on the federal level that's very, very significant right now, the movement of explosive hydrocarbons in substandard rail cars across this country and through our county. And I realize that a local decision will be made which would greatly intensify the danger in our county and elsewhere. But already we have oil trains running through about 3 times a week from San Ardo to Torrance. And we have had no say about that because no land use permit in our county has had anything to do with it. These things are just rolling through, probably on substandard tank cars, over one of the most dangerous stretches of rail in the state. And we keep being told the federal government preempts local dealing with these issues. Well, the federal government is who you are hiring people to talk to on our behalf. Is this sort of thing going to get on their menu? Should it? And can you discuss that now, please?
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Ms. Haynes, followed by Kate Ballantyne.
Good morning, Chairman Gibson, members of the board. Diana Haynes of the Public Works Department. We are amending consent agenda item number 1 by clarifying the resolution's noticing requirements per County Code Section 1350. The clerk has received the amended resolutions and additional copies. Thank you.
You do well. Thank you, Ms. Haynes. Ms. Ballantyne.
Good morning, Kate Ballantyne, also Public Works Department. We have another change for item number 23. The resolution refers to Exhibit A. Exhibit A was inadvertently not labeled, and I have correctly labeled replacement pages for the board and the clerk.
Thank you, Ms. Ballantyne. Mike Brown, followed by Dr. Seehite.
Mike Brown, representing CoLab, with respect to item 6, the recommendations from the grand jury. We think there's an opportunity here. It's something we've been concerned about. And what the grand jury is basically saying is there ought to be more public disclosure and information about the status of the retirement system. And the proposed answer here today is, well, we might tweak the the comprehensive annual financial report a little bit. That's a 180-page, very technical report, and most of the public and the media even is certainly not aware of its existence. We think the better practice would be that as part of one of your strategic budget sessions or on its own, that you would post a business item and have the administrator of the retirement system, the consulting actuary, and the auditor controller come in and give you a public briefing in here about the status of the system and about some of the alternatives. So, for example, in the latest actuarial report, it shows this $346 million unfunded liability that everybody, and it really needs a broad piece of attention by you and the availability to the public, not to have to go diving down into some website to look at what for the public is a pretty esoteric 180-page document, even if they've ever heard of it.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Dr. Height.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos. Item 13 and 15, funding the institutionalization of youth and adults. And I have a question, is the youth facility within the county limits? And I see that the moms, the dads, the grannies, and the grandpas who can't take care of themselves might be going to Merced. Is that true? Because the issue here is, at least it seems that most of your group homes for youth are within the county, so that doesn't force parents to simply abandon their children to carry on their lives or move outside of the county. But if you're institutionalizing the county's adults in another county, then grandma's abandoned, because who can work and take care of their kids and then drive to another county to visit grandma? The Olmstead Act is a U.S. Supreme Court decision that says that it presumes a false sense of worth to withhold the services that lead to institutionalization. Boy, I'd like to see, I know that this is confidential information, but I'd like to see a case review on some of this. Did the families get the support of the county before they got recommended for institutionalization? And will they ever get out? Where is your oversight? And is it the same kind of oversight we see in Los Osos? See no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. I'm not your quality control. You don't pay me to be your quality control on this matter, but I'm doing research, and I will come here, and I will tell you. This is in your preview, and I will tell you what your providers aren't going to tell you, because when they come before you, they've got their hand out for money. And what they won't tell you is that the institutionalization of youth in group homes and facilities is a gateway institutionalization to the youth authority and to jail. It is not preparing youth to live within the community. What they won't tell you is that Families First lost its license, and I'm very curious to see if this funding that's going forward after the budget, if any of this institutionalization of youth has an affiliation to Families First, because how many families and children have to be broken before a facility loses its license? It has to be at least three. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Height. That was our last request to speak on consent. So I'll close it to public comment, bring it back to the board, ask colleagues if they have items to pull. Supervisor Arnold?
Yes, please. 6, 9, 13, 18, and 24.
Okay. Mr. Hill?
6, please.
Mr. Meacham?
3 and 6.
And Ms. Ray?
3.
All right. We'll start with 3. Mr. Buckshy or Mr. Meacham, do you have Mr. Meacham, you have a question on that? Or
I don't have a question. I'm going to support this, and the reason why is that I remember last year when we talked about our, I guess we were kind of uncomfortable with spending this money with the federal lobbyists. I said then, and I'm going to say again, have we the need to seek Washington's help with the water situation with which we're confronted? I'm going to support this. I think that if we need to go back there and try to find any way that we can make inroads to Washington to assist with the state of California, I'm willing to do that. So I'm willing to give them one more shot and see what kind of help we can get with that, because I think we're in a real precarious situation.
Very good. Ms. Ray?
Well, I respect that point of view, definitely, and I do think there's other ways to get to that help. And for me, I think that it's too much money to spend on something that where we can, and even they can have very little effect. And that being said, just from a purely District 4 standpoint, we've needed significant federal help in the last year in providing or in obtaining permits from the Army Corps of Engineers and whatever else and at the federal level, and we've gotten nowhere with that. And so, to me, that's evidence that it's not getting done. So, for me, it's going to be no today.
So, you'd like to pull this for separate vote?
Yes, please.
I would observe, Supervisor Ray, that, I mean, the Ferguson Group connect us with the right people within the Army Corps of Engineers, and on the matter of the Cayucas Pier, some face-to-face discussions in Washington, D.C. in January produced results on permits within a week. And so, for $72,000, in a budget of $500 million, to me this is a very obvious investment well spent in terms of getting return on investment. So with that, Ms. Arnold, do you want to comment on 3? Or
just a quick question. Mm-hmm. I didn't pull 3, but I'm wondering, have we ever had any discussions about or investigated any other lobbying groups that may be familiar with this area or familiar with do a lot of lobbying with the committees, the issues that we tend to see?
We have in the past. It's been a couple years since we've done that. Certainly going out for an RFP is always an option.
Okay.
All right. So we will take that on a separate vote when we get done, but let's move on to item number 6. Ms. Arnold, would you like to bring that up?
Yes, please. So for me, this isn't... I'm repeating myself. I know I brought this up before, but it's important for me, I think, to publicly address these grand jury reports, things that the grand jury have identified as an area of concern. These are citizens that spend a lot of time, a lot of work, and again have identified certain issues that through their lens that are important for the either to educate the public or for the public to know about. So. In this particular, so generally speaking, I like to be able to take the grand jury report off the agenda and at least discuss it for a moment in this public forum. This particular report was just discussing the unfunded liability that the county has, that there's more need for transparency, and then the response from Mr. Erb seemed to be that these improvements, there are improvements coming that will be implemented. And I think the grand jury report states that their main concern was just the difference, the actuarially accrued asset value being $1.12 billion here in the county, and the actuarially accrued liability being $1.468 billion, leaving an unfunded liability of $0.346 billion. And we know over the so many years that the problems can rise, they might go away. It just all depends on so many things out of our control. But I think if we might ask Mr. Erb just for a moment, out of respect for the work that the grand jury did, to just assure us that he's on it, and I'm sure he is, and that
okay.
There'll be more transparency in the future.
Jim Erb, Auditor, Controller, Treasurer, Tax Collector. Yes, that is our unfunded liability. The numbers are, you know, I guess they're hard for some people to find. They're right there for us, and the grand jury was able to get to them pretty quickly. And we have been transparent with where we stand. We have a 30-year plan in place to reduce the unfunded liability. We're in year 26. We've done some things to help it along, like the go to Tier 2 before Pepper even came about, and then a year later we went to Tier 3. You know, we've reduced benefits. We've come up with 50-50 pension splitting in the future. So we're doing everything we can to reduce our pension costs. But the one thing we are doing, every year we have an actuarial study. So we have this 30-year plan, and they come in every year and they take a look at it. And they say, are we on track or not? And if we're not on track, that's when we see rates go up and potential changes. If we are on track, then everything kind of stays the same. This year I don't think we have any rate increases. Every 3 years they come back and they do an experience study where they look at the age of people passing away and make sure and the salary increases that have happened during that time and make sure that all of their assumptions are working and that they're intact. So we do monitor this thing very closely, and that information is put out there for people to look at.
Thank you for that.
We have other comments. We want to go to Mr. Buckshy first on some of these.
I could wait until the other supervisors make their comment, but I would like to make a few comments after that.
Mr. Hill and then Mr. Meacham.
Yeah, just quickly, you know, one of the things that was pointed out by Mr. Erb just now is that all of the information that the grand jury looked at to assess was basically our, you know, available from us, you know, through our website and other things. So I'm not sure how much more transparent other than making it blink on a website.
We have a thermometer or something.
Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, I would go a little bit further, and Mr. Erb does, and in the report, in fact, you know, I'm trying to think who wrote it, but we're not doing everything we can. We've done more than most, in fact, most of all of the other counties, in terms of reducing pension costs. And I know the three of us here,
non finances, it's available to anyone that wants to come and hear it. I think you're very fortunate in terms you don't belong to CalPERS. You have your own independent pension program here, and it's very well run. There have been some steps taken, but if you look statewide at the liabilities that have been created, they're huge. Our neighboring counties were left with some pretty heavy pensions that they have to pay out because of some top-heavy administrative costs. So I think that from our standpoint, I think you guys are doing a pretty darn good job, and I commend the Pension Trust Board for the work that they do.
Mr. Butchak? Oh, I'm sorry.
And we have dropped our assumption rate. We were at 7 3/4, and now we're down to 7 1/4. We're one of the lower in the state on this assumption. And it goes up and down. Last year we made over 13%. The year before that we made over 12%, and the year before that we made 2.3%. So it really goes up and down, and the actuaries try to figure out where our average will be, and that's the rate they are recommending that we adopt. If they don't think it's going to work, then they'll tell us that we would have to lower it.
I just thought I'd add a few additional comments for context. I think, you know, there's really the two issues in my mind that the grand jury brought up. And one is the reporting and the transparency issue, and the other is the status of the pension, the condition of the pension. And I think Mr. Erb hit on most of it. The documents are available. We meet all legal requirements with respect to reporting. And, in fact, the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, or GASB, is coming out with some additional requirements to further try to simplify reporting, and we fully intend to comply with that, or are on track to comply with that. So I think we're doing everything that has been required with respect to reporting. Did also want to add, as was noted, that the Pension Trust does meet monthly. It is a Brown Act body, and For anybody who wants to become a pension wonk, they go into as much detail as anybody can stomach. I personally find it quite interesting. I'm not sure that that makes me a little strange or not. But, you know, the second piece is the condition of the pension system, and it's something that is reviewed very regularly, you know, monthly, obviously, and even more so. And it's something your board has had a tremendous amount of focus on over the last few years, as was discussed. We've implemented a Tier 2 system going back about 4 years, and the Tier 3, which is the governor's pension reform, was put in place January of 13. And during that time frame, we held several public discussions on the pension and where things are at. We haven't held as much lately because we're letting this work its way through as people move out of the Tier 1 system and into Tier 2 and 3. We'll start to see some of those anticipated benefits. And to give you a feel for this, you know, the cost to the county in terms of the savings from a Tier 1 to a Tier 3 is a 75% difference in costs. Our costs are reduced by that amount, so it's dramatic. In addition, what I want to reassure your board is that we are watching this very closely, the pension board, the auditor's office, my office, in terms of the condition of the pension. All of the projections in terms of rates, the unfunded liability, as well as the funded portion, are all taken into consideration to the budget. So when we've been giving your board budget updates and forecasts, that is all considered. And then lastly, just to emphasize, you know, this information is also widely shared with our bond rating agencies. They scrutinize this stuff. It's like, you know, taking a final exam, if you will, when we're discussing these with the bond rating agencies. And as your board's aware, we do have the highest bond rating, a AAA rating of any county in the state.
Thank you. Mr. Meacham,
I was going to follow up with that. I was going to ask Dan, but you already answered the question. When the bond agencies take into consideration your rating, all of this is taken into consideration along with the pension situation and our financial capabilities. So to be rated where we are in terms of a AAA rating is pretty impressive,
right?
In my opinion, anyway.
See, one kind of exciting.
And as with the CAO, I'm kind of a wonk in that regard, too. I do enjoy listening to these reports because they're very extensive. Sometimes they can be complicated because of the language in them,
mm-hmm.
but I think when there's oftentimes questions that come from the Pension Trust Board that clarifies a lot of that. So thank you.
Okay. All right, thanks.
And Mr. Chair, just one last comment. I think that this discussion that we've just had and with Mr. Erb at the podium is really satisfied exactly what the grand jury or part of what the grand jury was wanting to do, quoting from their report, because the grand jury decided it was an important issue for the county citizenry to recognize and understand all of this liability, it initiated the investigation. So I think just this public discussion helped satisfy at least a part of what they were hoping to achieve.
Okay. And Ms. Arnold, you'd like to continue with number nine.
Number nine is a contract with Cal Fire, and I always want to call them CDF. I'll never break that habit. With Cal Fire, the contract is on file with the clerk, but not in our staff report. It's a $15 million+ contract.
A very, very efficient and professional fire department. The as any department in this county, we go through the regular budgeting process. And we participate as a department head working for Mr. Buckshy. And in that process, you as the board, of course, get to scrutinize any improvements or changes or reductions in our budgets. That allows you complete local control. And the same goes for the other districts and cities that we provide service to. So the county does maintain local control despite that it's a cooperative agreement with the state. The current contract is for $15.6 million. This is an increase of $657,000 or 5.7% increase. Some of that increase is due to increases in service. You're now going to have additional firefighters serving the Shandon Station to make sure that we have enough firefighters on the ground there with the lack of volunteer firefighters that we now have there. This was a decision by your board during the budgeting process. There's also some other increases due to one was something we left out of the previous budgets that was corrected, and the other 40% is an increase due to the actual administration and contract costs of the state. And these are done through a formula process at the state level, and we have little control over those increases. There has been some revenue increases in the budget this year, those are as a result of course more plan check fees, more grants that we've gotten this year. We do receive about $2.3 million of this budget from our contracts that run through the county contracts, such as Los Osos and Avila, as well as the airport contract for fire protection there. And to add to this, we do have six dispatch contracts in the county, and as of last night, the city of Morro Bay would like to move forward on a contract for dispatching services, both with the sheriff and the fire department. And we'll be bringing, the sheriff and I will be bringing that item to you in a couple of weeks, and then back to the city council for final approval. You know, be proud of your fire department. The Cal Fire County Fire relationship has been around since 1930. You have 16 fire engines that are county, but you benefit from 21 fire stations that are part of this consolidation. And I just want to conclude with, for the last 2 weeks, all of our personnel have been on duty. Either they're on fires in Northern California or they're here covering the home front. There's 240 of those firefighters up in Northern California. They've been on the fire lines throughout that period. And that sort of mutual aid that is provided up and down the state is a benefit, obviously, right now to Northern California. But when the time comes and we need that service, will benefit reciprocally for that. So your people are hard at work right now, and you should be quite proud of them. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Chief. Ms. Harley, you want to continue?
Yeah, really quickly before the Chief leaves, I appreciate, we all appreciate you during fire season, of course. That's an obvious one. But you are often the first responders to accidents in the rural area, too, vehicle accidents, heart attacks, all those things. So that's something maybe we don't always connect those dots, but you do a tremendous amount or provide tremendous services beyond the fire response to the citizens of the county. So I
yes,
thank you for
that. We're a full-service fire department, urban search and rescue, cliff and water rescue, certainly vehicle accidents, building collapse, structure fires. We will rescue cats out of trees. Yep. Just dial 9.
Awesome. Thank you.
Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Chief. Coming as a son of a fire chief, I have a passion for the fire guys, but maybe you could talk briefly about the relationship you have with the Fire Safe Council and what's being done there to try to prevent some of the fires that we hopefully don't happen.
Well, that's another very positive thing for this county, is I would say that the Fire Safe Council, who is chaired by Supervisor Meacham, is probably one of the most successful Fire Safe Councils in California. And I know that all of you on this board have supported this council always. And right now we have over $1 million in grant money that has been attained through varieties of sources that is being implemented on the ground or through education here in the county. Further, there's more opportunities that are coming with the SRA fee grants that will become available soon, as well as potential grants with cap and trade. This Fire Safe Council is made up of stakeholders from every discipline that could be touched by fire, whether it's utilities, insurance companies, environmental organizations, certainly political connected folks, as well as citizens at large. And all of you have representatives on that board. And therefore, we believe when a decision is made to implement a fuel reduction project or other type of prevention project shortage, that the county will respond appropriately and quickly to that need. Certainly the long-term water issues are not an emergency, and I'm not concerned with that, but the short-term one, the fire department, public works, health department, county admin, county OES, county ag, all are concerned about an emergency and are prepared now to respond appropriately to it.
Very good. Okay. Thank you, Chief.
Okay, thank
good
you.
Stuff. Supervisor Arnold, number 13.
Thank you. So we have two items on our agenda that are health agency items, contracts with one's the Center for Children, one's in Merced Behavioral Health Center, and combined, which would be 13 and 15 actually, combined representing the cost of the county of almost $1.5 million. Oh, I see Ann's already up here. I see. Thank you. But I know it's a little misleading in the staff report, and I just was hoping, and thank you for being here, that you would explain that. That isn't, or we're on a kind of a spend the money as needed basis. So,
right.
Thank you for your explanation.
Sure. For both of these contracts, we have a maximum allowable, and that is standard across all the same levels of care. For instance, with the kids programs, we have contracts with 10 facilities. None of them is a Families First agency, by the way. And they're all a standard maximum allowable. It's to allow us the flexibility to place kids where they need to be, where they best fit, and where there might be a bed available. I'd also like to say that due to the excellent collaboration and work of Social Services, Family Care Network, our department, over the years, we only have 10 kids placed out of county, whereas in Butte County, where I came from most recently, we had over 40. Mm. So we've done excellent work here as collaborations to keep kids home in kin care and other facilities. So,
and
same thing for the adult program. For Merced Manor, we have about 80 adults out of county placement who we are working to bring that level of care to the county.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else?
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Ms. Robin. Supervisor Arnold, number 18.
Yep, 18. 18 is an appointment to our Ag Preserve Review Committee, our Williamson Act Committee, and I really just wanted to thank Paul Hoover. I've known Paul a long time, and Paul's here. I didn't even see you out there with your hat on. Thank him as a representative from the wine industry for his willingness to serve on this very important committee. I think, you know, without the Williamson Act, the Ag Preserve, we would not have the agricultural economic base we do in this county that, you know, we all enjoy. So thank you for your willingness to serve, to preserve.
Yes, thank you for allowing, you know, obviously, wine and viticulture to have a seat. So we feel we are fairly significant on that side. So thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hoover. And Ms. Arnold, number 24.
Okay. I'm sorry to be monopolizing the consent agenda. But number 24 is Public Works is asking for more emergency contracting for the Nos Manto water pipeline repairs. And we've already had one pass through of that. I was hoping that we might be able to, or at least talk to my colleagues here publicly about looking into, and I see Dean's here, but depending on what our Public Works comes up with as they're investigating these leaks, there's been discussion about kind of the quick fix, and then we'll go back in later for a permanent fix. And I know I've talked to Supervisor Meacham about this, that I would sure be happy to see us give direction for a permanent fix right away. We, a lot of our municipalities are dependent on that pipeline, and we're just about to ask for a $4 million grant from the state for a tie-in that depends on that pipeline being fully functioning. So I think I would like to have a discussion about going in the direction of a permanent fix as quickly as we can.
Mr. Meacham?
I agree with the permanent fix once we know what the problem, the extent of the problem is. I think at this particular point, Mr. Benedict can respond to that, but this is becoming a little bit more concerning as we go. Mm-hmm. And so I think once the full investigation of what's going to be necessary, then that would come back for the full fix. But I think at this point, I think we are interested in looking at a permanent fix, but we don't know what that looks like at this point.
Quick update, Mr. Benedict.
Yes, Dean Benedict, Utilities Division Manager. Good morning. We have met with had a special meeting with the Nos Manto Technical Support Group 2 weeks ago, and they there was their preference for us to proceed with a permanent fix, not do something temporary. To date, we have found 6 or 7 leaks in that specific 1,800 length of pipeline. We are tomorrow we will finish doing our video of that pipeline, and we'll be by the end of the week going over to another section of 1,300 foot pipeline, which is identical. To see if we have issues with that also. In parallel, we have been working.
Ms. Ray?
No.
Ms. Arnold?
No.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. And at this point, I would then entertain a motion on the balance of consent as amended.
So moved.
Thank
Second.
You, Mr. Meacham. Thank you, Mr. Hill. And another roll call vote, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, staff. That brings us then to public comment for items not on our agenda and within the subject matter jurisdiction of the board. We'll go with the slips on the dais at this point, which I think number 9 at this point. We'll start with Eric Greening, followed by Mike Brown.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening. We had a very interesting RAC meeting last Wednesday, and one piece of information that we heard was that former Supervisor Achajian, now Assemblymember Achajian, was going to base his action relative to the legislation on the water district for the Paso Robles Basin on the supervisor's opinion relative to the final current language, which supposedly won't change again. And his deadline for that is tomorrow, the 13th. At the time we were discussing it at the RAC, it would have been possible for you to have agendized the taking of such a position. However, even though I raised Brown Act concerns with the report on the way it was going to be done, apparently it did not get on today's agenda. What we were told was that each of you was instructed to communicate with Assemblymember Achajian your own personal opinion about the legislation, that he would take that, presumably counting the noes as the majority sentiment of that, and use it as his guidance. This is the people's business on the legislative platform. He seems to be asking for a serial meeting. We, the people, have not seen in the context of a Board of Supervisors staff report the current language on which you are being asked to give direction. I simply see no way now that you can give any direction, either publicly or privately. To do it publicly, you would have to make the finding to add an agenda item right now today based on the need for the action having arisen in the last 72 hours. It did not arise in the last 72 hours. It was known as of last Wednesday when we were discussing it at the RAC. If you have a second thought and decide you should do it in public, that's not the same thing as the need for the action, and the public has not been notified. But certainly, I would strongly urge you not to engage in a serial meeting, not to set any precedent for the convenience of such serial meetings, and to remind Assemblymember Achajian that he was once a supervisor. Yes, the legislature is exempt from the Brown Act. They exempted themselves. But you are not. And you need first and foremost to keep your noses clean.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Mr. Brown, followed by Gary Kirkland.
Mike Brown, representing CoLab. Mr. Greening covered part of the issue here with respect to the local processing of AB 2453. This is the missing agenda item today. I realize that this is in part some sort of manufactured nicety of your past decision to take the issue out of the legislative program, but nevertheless, that does not really relieve you from this, one of the most important issues in years, from having a discussion. So we have no idea whether or not each of you have communicated with the assemblyman and what that communication says, and then what you think is the basis for your support or non-support of the current version of the bill. So the public's deprived of that, and that's, I think, highly problematical. It would, you know, rather than having to file records requests, it would be great if the county executive could collect your 5 emails, responses, or whatever, and have them so we could pick them up and see what you say or what you're telling the assemblyman about this. Otherwise, within the bill, one of them is supposed to, you know, do an independent feasibility analysis of applications for this creation of a new government entity. So if you're an applicant, how then do you sit there and judge this application independently?
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Mr. Kirkland, followed by Ben DeFatto.
Thank you very much. I have two issues. One is on this one that Mike Brown was just talking about. I urge you, if you're going to secretly contact Chadian and Assemblyman Chadian and tell him your position, I hope it's that you will oppose the water district because it is a taking of people's property rights and allow people to take care of their own property, which is what our country was founded on. The other issue came up a couple of weeks ago. One of the supervisors, Mr. Hill, mentioned that he is a fiscal conservative or fiscally responsible but socially tolerant or socially liberal is what he said. And I want to congratulate him on that. Being a libertarian, that's one of our mottos. And we very much support him in his efforts on that. And in that regard, I hope he and the other board members would, whenever they see a law that is going to take away people's rights and take away their freedoms, that he would vote no on that. And also that he, being fiscally responsible, he would urge people, if they want something, to pay for it, not go into debt with bondage and bonds or pass higher taxes. And I'm sure he'll do that, and we'll have a freer and a better country if he does that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kirkland. Mr. DeFatto, followed by Dr. C. Height.
Good morning, Board, Sheriff, Public. I'm Ben DeFatto from Los Angeles here to regurgitate old stuff. After the last meeting 3 weeks ago when Ms. Thacker was about a minute into her comments and not knowing what she was going to say, you proceeded to shut her down because you did not want to hear the rest of her story that I think the public had a right to hear. On the docket that day, it was going to be a light day. There were only 7 speakers that turned in their slips. That's 21 minutes. You spoke for 4 or 5 minutes on why you took that action. You asked the county administrator to comment. That took another 4 or 5 minutes. Then you asked the county council to comment. That took another 4 or 5 minutes. All total took about 15 minutes. All this to stop her last 2 minutes of comments that you, Mr. Gibson, did not want the public to hear. And also, with your finger on the red button, you called in 2 sheriff's departments, the deputies, to come here for fear of a riot, I guess. Nobody threw their shoes at you or the board. Nobody screamed, "Chill out, Bruce." I would like to know why you do these things. Why you have to have this attitude, why we should not be listened to according to you. All this to silence Ms. Thacker and 3-4 others from commenting on the history of Pavo, the county, and this expensive wrongdoings to the people of Los Osos, with your choosing the most expensive, unaffordable, antiquated, stinking gravity sewer without looking at the proven, better technology alternative sewer systems that have come on the market in the last 20 years that would have saved us at least $100 million. May we remind you that the one making phony rules to silence the people of this county that the county's council and administrator pointed out, only you have the right to silence people that pay your salary. We have this problem every time you become a chairman. You also try to sway other people, newly appointed chairpersons, every time, usually on the first day he or she takes office. A little impatient or just a little bully in the schoolyard that wants the kid's nickel he saved for a soda pop. You all work for the citizens of this county and not Gibson Enterprises, LLC, or are you always in a rush to a hot date later on? Now that the sewer pipes are all in, then why do we have to wait another 2 more years for the treatment plant to be completed? Was this mismanagement or just another big blunder on your part? You could have started the treatment plant 2 years ago to be completed to coincide with the completion of the pipes in the streets. Let's not forget that another year or so will go by for the hookups to the house. Another 3 more years will go by before we can start to recharge our level bases. That's I got 5 more pages, sir, but In reality, a matter of concern is the county pension unfunded liability,
Dr. Height, followed by Julie Tacker.
Dr. C. Height.
I'd like to talk just about the process regarding the letter from Assemblyman Asagio.
The process that the amendments are wrapped and hidden behind, there's a deception going on.
Good afternoon, Cindy Steinbeck. I tried to speak to the process this morning in public comment, and I wasn't allowed to, so...
their expectations of what they plan for coming out of Locust, the county will be working collaboratively to make sure their cities have what they need.
Yeah, I think, that's I've been in agreement that
some months ago I was here and I expressed concern over the Oceano Community Services District hiring him and
would public comment for items not on the agenda and under the purview of the Board of Supervisors.
Correct.
I'd like you to bring it back to what has to do with the Board of Supervisors.
Correct. And
carry on.
Thank you, I think.
Thank you, Dr. Height. Ms. Tacker, followed by Lindy Owen.
Good morning. I am Julie Tacker, and I will thank Dr. Height, too. That was actually rather revealing. Mr. Gibson, you did interrupt my public comment 3 weeks ago, suggesting that the Oceano Community Services District General Manager, former San Luis Obispo County Public Works Director Pablo Ogren and his salary were not within your purview. As long as Mr. Ogren is a part of your pension plan, he's in your purview. Moreover, as he positions the Oceano Community Services District to sell water, whether it be to a development or to the cities of Arroyo Grande, Grover Beach, or the community of Napomo, whether it be state water, which you are the contractor, they are the subcontractor, Lopez, they are the county manages Lopez, they are a contractor. He's in your purview. What's happening in Oceano is in your purview. Speaking of what's happening in Oceano, Ms. Ray, you recently posted the Tribune story about Viva Farms on your Facebook page. And with it, I have to quote you, you said, "This is the power of being supervisor. I insisted the neighbors be heard and the investigation be redone, despite serious resistance. There are many people to be thanked. In the end, the people won." Which people? Certainly not the people of Oceano, as the operation of some 60 trucks a day is now moved to Oceana. How does that square 60 extra trucks a day in the Highway 1 corridor with revitalization? How does it square being across the street from the proposed equestrian staging area where additional trucks and horse trailers will be impacting the area? Nobody asked Oceano. Something else that doesn't square with Oceano is the upcoming Huckfest event. some 20,000 plus people are coming to Oceano. The CEQA document comes out this Friday. The event is October 18th. Your legal counsel has weighed in to suggest that you do not have the ability or the need to require a permit for the use of your land, county public land, the La Grande Tract, and that the state park process will be enough.
Thank you, Ms. Tacker.
I disagree.
Ms. Owen, followed by Richard Margetson.
Good morning, Lindy Owen from Los Osos. I'm glad everybody's refreshed from another two-week vacation. But you left us remembering with Mr. Gibson's reprimands against Julie Tacker, and I just want to again question, does he really want to shut out public comment from the sometime in the future? As we head towards a time when we may be having to actually import truckloads of water to our homes, like Cambria went through, I think we need to stop this game of thinking that development needs to continue right now. We're in a severe crisis, and it's time for a red flag over all new development, as far as I'm concerned. The governor's request for a 20% reduction through conservation was very reasonable, but then lo and behold, he wasn't real happy that it only amounted to 5 or 6% statewide. But my question is, where is the conservation on the private wells and the agriculture? Why would the private homes be forced to take a 20% reduction and not even a 5% reduction from farms and ag? It isn't fair, and it really needs to be brought forward that we need to put meters on wells to understand how much use is coming through and encourage them to join in to this issue of trying to save what we have left of water so that we all have a little bit. In Los Osos, after 10 years of awareness of saltwater intrusion, we're probably the leaders in the county on conservation. And we didn't get it from the $5 million that was never spent on our water conservation charges from the sewer project. We did it by rate structure and also an awareness. So we're probably the ones that everybody should come look at. And we're down to 51 gallons per day per person. So
thank you, Ms. Owen. Mr. Margetson, followed by Bill Pelfrey.
Richard Margetson. I haven't done this for a while, so I went online to look at the Los Osos update for the wastewater project, and as of the end of June, 51 washing machines have been replaced in Los Osos. The annual goal was 400 per year for 5 years. At the rate we're going, it'll take 65 years to replace the 2,000 toilets that were the goal of this plan. As of June 30th, 2,332 toilets have been replaced in the first 20 months of the program. By December 31st, 2013, the goal was 3,000. So we're halfway into the second full year. You haven't even reached the goal for the first year. Now everybody's concerned about PASO, trying to develop plans on how to save it, save the basin. Cambria has their issues, emergency declarations to get plans through the Coastal Commission for a temporary fix. You have a program in Los Osos that's funded, but is not even coming close to meeting the goals. And I believe the reason is it's not being advertised sufficiently. Oh yeah, we got a flyer that was sent out 6 months ago. Nothing. There's no signs up around town. There's no newspaper articles. There's no ads. There's nothing. We have a number of small newspapers in town. Nothing. County's done nothing. This is our way of saving water in Los Osos that's already funded. I'd like somebody to take the lead and get this program moving. The money is there. All of the toilets, shower heads, and aerators have to be replaced before any resident in the prohibition zone can hook up to the wastewater project. Why isn't it better to be done sooner than later? That's how we save water. District engineer at a recent utilities meeting in Los Osos stated that the basin currently is 400 acre feet out of bounds. And I know toilets aren't going to solve that problem, but it's a start. My last 22 seconds, I just want to comment on CAL FIRE. It's the best thing that ever happened to Los Osos. It was almost 10 years ago to the date that it was a very contentious issue in Los Osos. Ended up saving the community $250,000 a year annually, and the contract cost has averaged less than 1% increase in the entire period.
Thank you, Mr. Margetson. Mr. Pelfrey.
Morning. Bill Pelfrey, Templeton. I'm a member of We the People of this county. You are our supervisors. Each of you have a district, but overall you're responsible for our county. The most important thing in this county is water. How many times has that been said? Now, Assemblyman Akajian up in Sacramento has a bill. Indoctrinated your ICLEI programs that gives you oversight, or the committees that give you oversight over us. Right now, we still function by the Constitution. The same things that you swore when you came to office. I know two of you are no longer live up to that, but the other three should. The public has a right to know. Mr. Gibson, you already did this once with a letter, taking it upon yourself. Public came out and told you about it. But now you're doing it, the whole board, they send a letter. That's nothing more than public comment. That's not a Board of Supervisor recommendation. Mr. Akajian should be up there saying, well, it's not recommended by the Board of Supervisors because they decided not to have a meeting on it. That was your responsibility, to inform the people, to let them know the changes, to have a lively discussion right here. You said no. What does that make you?
That was our last request to speak in public comment, so I'll close it to the public. And let me observe on the matter. We had a couple of commenters speaking to Assemblyman Ashajian's letter to the board individually as regards AB 2453. He made it clear that he was asking the opinion of each supervisor individually. He didn't ask for this item to be agendized for a vote of the board. None of my colleagues asked for it to be agendized for discussion and or direction of the board as a whole. And, in fact, I don't see any Brown Act issues at all. I'll defer to counsel to follow up if I've missed something. But the question of whether to pursue moving AB 2453 through the state Senate is Assemblyman Ashajian's alone. He was asking the opinion of five members of this Board of Supervisors individually, and I gave him mine. I assume my colleagues gave him theirs, and he is now doing what he's doing. It's not a decision of the Board of Supervisors, which is the subject of the Brown Act. And again, if counsel would like to amplify on that, or if I missed something, and she demurs at this point. So I'll go to Supervisor Arnold and then Supervisor Ray.
Thank you. I just want to express publicly and remind the public that it is not this. It's not our bill. That this Board of Supervisors was not the sponsor of this bill. At the very beginning, two private groups, Prags and Pro Water Equity, asked for the creation of a new water district. This is important to me because it represents the formation of a new governmental entity with the authority to tax and regulate the property owners within my district. One of the basis for wanting a new district by the sponsors is that they didn't think that the existing district, the County Flood Control and Water Conservation District, was the appropriate entity to manage a district in the Paso Basin, both the supply side and management side of the groundwater, that it was not the appropriate entity because three of the supervisors up here don't represent the basin. It was also the wishes of PRAGS and Pro Water Equity, the proponents of the new water district, to include special state legislation in the formation of this new district. So now it's interesting that the ground rules, which include additional regulatory authority that the new district may have, is being decided in Sacramento. This board's opinion, support or opposition, has been asked for, but I'll repeat, we did not sponsor this bill, and many amendments to this bill have been brought by legislators from other parts of the state. So I agree with Chairman Gibson, and I encourage people to read the bill in its entirety. It's really grown. And support or opposition on your part should be directed to the author of the bill, our Assemblyman Nishajian.
Ms. Ray, can you have your light on?
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to comment real quickly, and again, we haven't agendized this, so we can't talk about that, but I do want to say that I do think that it's important for the public to know where we stand on this, and I've been pretty clear on where I stand, but I wanted to offer that I will try to get to this later today if I think of it. I will post my written response to CACHO on my website so you can all read it.
All right. With that, then, we'll move on to our business items of the day. Madam Clerk, if you would introduce our next item, please.
Your next item is 29, a hearing to consider a resolution to approve the issuance of tax-exempt bonds not to exceed $5 million by the California Municipal Finance Authority for the Ocean View Manor Affordable Housing Project and execute a joint exercise of power agreement between the county and CMFA, all districts.
Izir Dai, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the board. Susanna Dai, Planning and Building. This is going to be a quick public hearing to acquire and rehabilitate 40 units that are affordable at Ocean View Manor in Morro Bay, and they're asking the California Municipal Finance Authority to issue the bonds that is not going to exceed $5 million. And so with that, we have to hold a public hearing, and the county has no legal or financial obligations or any responsibilities to repay the bonds. And our recommendation is that the board adopt the attached resolution approving the issuance of bonds by the California Municipal Finance Authority and also execute a joint powers agreement with California Municipal Finance Authority to become a member. So that's our first public hearing.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Adai. Any questions from the board? Seeing none, I'll open it to the public. I have no request to speak. And seeing no one coming forward, I'll bring it back to the board for an action. I'll take the chair's prerogative, as this is District 2, and move staff's recommendation.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. With no further discussion, Madam Clerk, a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Yes. And if you would then, Madam Clerk, introduce item 30.
Item 30. It's a hearing to consider a resolution to approve the issuance of tax-exempt bonds not to exceed $4.5 million by the California Municipal Finance Authority for financing the Los Robles Terrace Affordable Housing Project and execute a joint exercise of power agreement between the county and CMFA, all districts.
All right. Ms. Adai?
Yes, so this is the second public hearing again, and it's a TEFRA hearing for Los Robles Terrace in Paso Robles. And again, People's Self-Help Housing Corporation is seeking for tax-exempt financing to acquire and rehabilitate 40 units, and they're the same units, for Los Robles Terrace in Paso Robles. And again, they're asking the California Municipal Finance Authority, known as CMFA, to issue the bonds that would not exceed $5 million. And staff recommends that your board adopt the attached resolution approving the issuance of bonds by CMFA to benefit Los Robles Terrace, and also execute the joint powers agreement with CMFA.
Thank you. Mr. Meacham?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming that the Los Robles Terrace will now have the view from
Ocean View.
Ocean
yes.
View. I have a question, Wes, I think I asked yesterday, relative to the amount of money that's going to be expended for administrative costs as opposed to upgrades. Is there a distinct...
I have an answer. So we have a preliminary breakdown of the expenses. 60% of the bond proceeds will go to acquisition, and 30% will go to rehabilitation, and 10% goes for other uses. But these are all preliminary estimates, and I have Anthony Stops from CMFA in the audience that he can expand on the answer. And
so only 30% of this is going to go to improvements?
Yes, to rehab.
But 60% for the acquisition, they're buying,
right.
the property
buying the
and then,
property.
Yes. then rehabbing.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
And Ms. Adai, I think I heard you say not to exceed $5 million. Our staff report says $4.5 million.
For the second, $4.5 million. Yes.
So as
Los Robles Terrace.
Okay. Other questions? Seeing none, I'll open it to the public. I have no request to speak, and seeing no one coming forward, I'll close it. To the public, Mr. Meacham.
Move staff recommendation.
Thank you.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. And Madam Clerk, another roll call vote, please.
Mr. Meacham.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill.
Yes.
Ms. Ray.
Yes.
Ms. Arnold.
Yes.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes. Pleasure of my colleagues, a break now or break after the next item? After? So, with that, if you would introduce the next item, please.
Certainly. Your next item is item 31, receive and file a report on performance measures for Transitions Mental Health Association's all districts.
Ms. Robin, welcome to the dais. Is this the best IT help you can secure? I'm just checking. He looks like he knows what he's doing.
I was just going to recognize and thank my IT assistant.
Yeah.
The doctor is in.
Yeah.
And specified in a contract we have with the State Department of Healthcare Services to provide services for adults with serious mental illness and youth with serious who are seriously emotionally disturbed. These are certain diagnoses that are listed. There's about 11 qualifying diagnoses. But the other part is that they also have to have a substantial functional impairment. So there are individuals who are in the community who have schizophrenia who function independently with the benefit of support and medications. They may not need our services. However, the majority of folks with serious mental illness do need our rehabilitative services as well as our medical and therapeutic services. So TEMA, who's been a contractor with the county for many years and has been a wonderful partner, has 26 distinct programs contracted with the county for seriously mentally ill adults and SED kids. They fall into the categories of housing, employment, treatment, wellness and recovery, outreach and engagement, and community education. Well, here's our methodology. We do track outcomes, program service levels, performance measures quarterly. We have meetings with the contractor, all of our contractors, quarterly to determine how they are coming to their goals that are specified in their contract. TEMA itself has several evaluation tools they've developed over the years, including satisfaction surveys, pre-post surveys, presentations. They have intake forms, attendance sheets, and other elements that they're developing continuously and doing a CQI process to continuously improve the quality of their services. Let's talk about housing for a few minutes. So having housing has allowed me to focus on many other factors that badly needed attention. I can set a schedule, have healthy meals at home, and apply myself to personal group therapy. I'm so grateful to have a home and support. That's one of the residents in the TEMA housing. So there are several housing programs. I'll just highlight a couple. One is the adult transitional programs, 12 beds. They had 18 different occupants in the fiscal year. They had 3,812 bed days filled. 11 out of these folks were homeless when they were admitted to the program. 14 out of them transitioned back out into the community to a lower level of care. 9 of these folks actually got paid employment in the community. And 14 of these individuals reduced or had no incarceration days. The youth treatment program, 9 beds, have had 19 kids in this year. This is a step-down program from some of those group homes or to prevent kids from going out of county. So 14 out of the 19 kids who were housed at this program actually were diverted from either going to an out-of-county placement or a different higher level of care. There are 40 beds in 10 different locations that are master leased. They're in houses with congregate living. Number of people have their individual bedrooms. There's a couple of shared bedrooms where adults can reside with care and support in a setting that is conducive to their recovery, their wellness, and also keep them here in the county and avoiding them going out of county to higher levels of care or back to jail. Employment. So we all know what employment does for us. What would you do all day if you didn't have kind of an employment? You'd be bored watching TV. Our clients are the same. They shouldn't have to be sitting watching TV all day, just, you know, wondering what next, focused on their illness rather than focused on the community and having concrete things to do. There is a saying in the recovery movement that the goal of recovery is to have a home, a job, and a date for the weekend. So that's kind of the theme for all of these programs. So in the Growing Grounds Nursery, which I've already told Ms. Bolster-White that when I retire, I want to work there. I am a master gardener. It's my preference to be playing in the dirt, but this is a great job for now, and then hopefully I can move on to that when I retire. 76 individuals have been in the rehab services. This is a cooperative program with the Department of Vocational Rehabilitative Services. 28 of the 76 folks who had some vocational skill building at Growing Grounds Nursery moved on to a job development program, which is the next step in getting ready for community competitive employment. And then 12 of those 76 actually entered community independent work settings, real paid jobs, like real people, like our folks are. Vocational training and supported employment, 167 folks were served. Again, 52 out of these folks got community employment. And this is 31% compared to the statewide average of 27% for adults with serious mental illness achieving competitive employment through the Department of Vocational Rehabilitation. So our programs exceed the state average in successful placements. 38 of these individuals gained and maintained community employment for at least 90 days, which is the Department of Vocational Rehabilitation measure. 21 of these folks participated in the actual co-op. 7 of these folks were back into the community as full citizens. There's also the downtown retail vocational program. That store specifically is for people who want to go into retail. Now remember, a number of the folks who participate in these employment programs may have never held a job in their lives. They have been so seriously mentally ill, seriously disabled, that they've never even entertained having a job. So again, we're not talking people who have intermittent problems with depression or anxiety. We're talking the folks who we treat, people with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression, who have been unable to live independently, who have been unable to go to work, who may not have even been successful in completing high school due to their mental illness. So these success rates are excellent. These folks who want to work in retail get the opportunity to work at this downtown plant store in order to learn how to deal with the public, develop communication skills, customer service, things that are all very necessary to work in a service economy. So let me move on to some of the more complicated programs. Treatment supports. TEMA provides case management and peer supports for a number of programs that are MHSA funded. The full service partnerships are the most intensive level of outpatient care that we have. It has a low staff to client ratio. It's meant to be done as a team so that there's a team of folks with different skill sets helping each consumer, each individual, in meeting their treatment goals. The primary outcomes for the full service partnerships are reductions of homelessness, incarceration, the use of emergency medical services or psych hospitalizations, and to increase overall community function. This is the cornerstone of the MHSA program for community services and supports. It's in regulation that at least 50% of the community services and supports MHSA funding go to FSP-type programs. So for all of the full-service partnerships combined, 28 out of 67 individuals received housing, and 26 out of those 28 maintained housing longer than 60 days. I don't have statewide comparative data yet. The state is having difficulty getting that out of the system that we've been putting it in, but we're working on getting that. 20 out of these 67 folks had 299 psychiatric inpatient days during the year prior to service. The same folks had only 79 inpatient days the year following while they were in service. So that's the way the measures are counted. There's a, it's called a partnership assessment form. It's done for the year prior to entering service, all of these measures. And then during the year of service, initial year of service and ongoing, they measure all these different variables. So 10 individuals had 472 jail days prior, and they only had 51 jail days after joining the program. And then 42 of the individuals had 106 ER interventions. Afterwards, only 30. So you can see the reduction in need for emergency services, in cost to the community, cost to law enforcement, and other things by this intensive case management, therapy, medication, and housing managed program. Okay, come on, clicker. There we go. There are 33 beds in intensive residential housing, 6 locations, 41 folks, 38 of them retained their housing at least 6 months, and all of these folks, 34 of these folks met the HUD definition of homelessness, which is chronic homelessness, number of homeless periods of homelessness over the last 5 years. So I'm not going to go over the rest of the details, but you get the idea of the FSP level of care and the intensity of care. Let's move on to wellness and recovery, which is another aspect of TEMA's work. There are 3 wellness centers, San Luis Obispo and Arroyo Grande, and 1 up in Atascadero. And in San Luis and Arroyo Grande, they've served 324 individuals. Most of these individuals have open cases with the Department of Behavioral Health, but it's also open to community members who may not be involved in our system of care but might have needs to have wellness activities, peer support. Perhaps they have private insurance and they want to come in and attend some groups. They're, everybody's welcome. The Atascadero Clinic Wellness Center served 207 individuals. And for an example, they had 1,583 contacts, which means they actually participated in a class, a pre-vocational activity, a social support activity, or one-on-one peer counseling. So you can see the breadth of those programs that are run relatively inexpensively for the level of care they provide to a broad swath of the community. SLO Hotline. I know there's been a lot of interest in the SLO Hotline. I have to put my glasses on. So in the fiscal year, they received 5,725 calls. The number of callers choosing to participate in a post-call survey, so a week after the call, when the call happens, they're asked, would you be okay if we called you next week to see how it went? And so they were able to get the number, follow up, and call them. Only 33 people agreed to that. However, when we compare it with a lot of rural areas, there seems to be some correlation between rural areas, gun ownership, and some other factors in suicide. We are still high. We rank in 2013, we had 16.3 out of 100,000 persons compared to the state average of 10.6. An average of one person every 13 minutes committed suicide in the United States in 2011. And the 10th ranking cause of death nationwide, and the 2nd for young people of ages 10 to 24. So suicide is a huge concern of ours. And this hits everybody. It doesn't just hit our seriously mentally ill, it hits a number of folks. And especially concerning are the youth. Any questions about SLO Hotline? They provide the crisis services, warm line services, support for people who are in distress, and they also provide a lot of information referral for first-time callers.
And there you can access SLO Hotline through a 211 call or directly to the SLO Hotline.
The 800 number for the SLO line. Can you do a 211?
211 transfer, the 1-800 you go to a microphone?
Okay. The 211 will transfer a warm handoff.
Very good.
Okay. So one of the new programs this year that's just rolling out that is through a grant is Medi-Cal Outreach and Engagement Services. This is a collaboration with public health, with behavioral health, and OTEMA to get underserved folks enrolled in Medi-Cal. And as you know, a number of our folks who are homeless or addicted or in jail or who have mental illness have not been able to get through the process of signing up for Medi-Cal. It's not an easy process. So OTEMA will be providing peer supporters to help get people enrolled in Medi-Cal, and we'll be working with Susanna and Nora from Public Health Department to and Catherine Thomas, one of our folks, to get this number of folks signed up for Medi-Cal in this year. It's a large number. It's it's a large goal, but we hope that they'll be able to succeed and surpass these goals. Talk briefly about community education, advocacy, and support. One of the things that TEMA does is provide family services, which supports the families of adults with who have mental illnesses, and Youth Family Partners work as a team with the families and caregivers of minors. So again, this is part of that whole collaborative braiding to support the families of persons and kids with mental illness, to keep them in the community, receive the best services they can, give education to the families about how best to work with their loved one at home, if possible. So they served over 670 family members. They had almost 3,000 contacts. They provided 6 parenting classes, which was specific of how to do parenting for youth with mental illness. Peer services. One of the things about peer service, and we know this out of the addictions field, that people have been there, have special knowledge and empathy and ability to connect with and engage with persons suffering from the same issues. So peer services for mental health is much newer. It's been around 10, 12, 15 years max that I can recall in my field, where it's been in the addictions field since, you know, Bob and Bob back there in the 30s with the Blue Book and AA. So one of the programs is Peer Advisory and Advocacy Team, which is a committee of peers who advocate for those served by mental health system, educate community, promote wellness and recovery, reduce stigma, and provide support for those living with a mental illness. One of the interesting statistics about this is that 19 of the 29 PAT members of that fiscal year actually gained paid work within the behavioral health system. So it's also a way to develop those work skills by learning how to advocate, speak, train. Slow the Stigma. You guys did a fabulous, fabulous Slow the Stigma video. I had the opportunity to witness it in Sacramento with Dr. Baylor and Cacho when it was shown up there a couple of years ago. Fabulous example of how media can give a message that helps. There are also other community education and stigma reduction strategies that are happening, including a number of In Our Own Voice peer presentations, professional education trainings, community presentations. One of the values of doing community education and stigma reduction, as I mentioned yesterday, was that if you have a lot of stigma about mental health, which anytime you open a newspaper, you can find stigmatizing language regarding people with mental illness. If we can educate the community, if we can educate an employer or a landlord, we might have better access to jobs for our folks or somebody who's willing to rent to our folks. So reducing stigma not only makes it easier for people to access care because they're not ashamed of their illness, but it also helps the community support people because they're educated that it's not such a scary thing to deal with, and people with mental illness are like any of us. They just need extra supports and they need some assistance to learn how to live in the community. So, in summary, mental illness is a
application of our resources to treat a fundamental human condition that needs and deserves our help is going to require a lot of careful thought. And I know that Ms. Robin is in the middle of analyzing what we do. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to the conversation, Mr. Hill. You have comments on the same topic.
Yeah, I do. One of the things that we discussed with Ms. Robin and Mr. Hamm and have had previously is And, you know, these are the kinds of things that are so important to the community, and it's important for us to be able to discuss it with the community, is, and it's going to take some time, certainly for Ms. Robin, but a thorough analysis of how we spend and even evaluate the efficacy of our spending so that we can better understand. We've talked about this in greater detail yesterday, you know, the truest needs in the community when it comes to behavioral health, the gaps that exist, and a lot of the gaps that exist are due to the way that funding is constrained, but gaps in programs and services, and even, you know, even failures in ways that happen because of these gaps. And essentially, you know, what can we, you know, what comes from that is what can we do to better address areas with the, you know, with the greatest social costs. And, you know, we know that there's a variety of different social costs that come with untreated mental illness, or with people who are experiencing problems with medication or lack of medication. And, you know, that can be everything from the police calls to incarceration to visits to the emergency rooms and PUF and those sorts of kinds of things that always end up costing a lot more. And I do appreciate the fact that Ms. Robin is going to spend a lot of time analyzing this, because for us it is important it's connected with so much of what we do in terms of some of the other programs and some of the other things that we take on, whether it's law enforcement or homelessness or some of the other issues, quality of life issues that come up, and then just the, you know, the health and welfare of our citizens. And when it comes to, and I think she makes a good point, Ms. Robin makes a good point about, you know, the time that we spend on trying to defeat the stigma related to mental health. Probably one of the greatest problems that exists from my perspective of the stigma is that it's an institutionalized thing. Mm-hmm. It's a systematic thing, because we have a healthcare system that treats mental health issues far differently than it does physical issues. And until that changes, and I don't know when that will happen, it's certainly something that has gotten better in over time, but we still have a system where people who have physical illnesses will be able to have treatment, though very often without proper insurance that may not be possible. Mm-hmm. But no doctor would say about any physical illness that, you know, we're just going to see how it works out, or, you know, or something. There's just not the same kind of attention that comes from the mental health system that is, this, you know, as you point out, nobody chooses to have a mental illness just as nobody chooses to have cancer. The way we respond to cancer in this country, as opposed to the way we respond to mental illness, is dramatically different at the systematic level. And I think that creates as much stigmatization as anything. So I appreciate the time and attention that you've put in today and that you're going to be putting in going forward.
Thank you. Yeah.
Ms. Arnold?
I just wanted to say thank you. It was a very informative presentation. So
thank you.
With that, we do have a couple of requests to speak. Mr. Brown, followed by Mr. Greening.
Mike Brown, representing CoLab. The issue for us is the state of the art of government performance measurement. We have no complaints or criticisms of transitions or the county mental health effort. What we're concerned with is the rigor and deployment of performance measures, and we're glad that you had this discussion. And it would be good if you had a similar presentation scattered over the year from at least each of the departments, because here you had little interpretation of what the measures mean and everything, and some facts. But at the same time, we think and we don't expect transitions or perhaps even mental health professionals to be experts in designing measures. That's more the function of the county administrator and other staffs who study the stuff. But take the one here, and again, this is not a criticism, it's an illustration of the technique. The hotline, I presume they get their name or something, do any of them ever commit suicide? Is there some way to get at whether this is really helping that problem? So in the end, we think every measure should contain five critical elements. The action that you're taking, the problem that it ostensibly solves, the current state of the problem. We have X suicides or we have X fires or whatever it is. The proposed state, where you want to get, and then the time interval you're going to get there. If you have that, you'd be way ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Mr. Greening.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I do have one question about what you might call a sort of a gray area in services, and that has to do with neurological conditions. They're not exactly the same as mental illnesses, but they can have sort of mimicking effects. I should actually make the personal comment that almost half century ago, I had a neurological condition that was misdiagnosed and mistreated as a mental illness. I was having complex partial seizures. In those days, it was called psychomotor, where you don't go down right away. You might even walk a fair distance, but you're not exactly responsive to conversation or anything like that, and then you go down. The powers that be decided on a snap judgment that I had schizophrenia, and I was mistreated for a disease I didn't have. Obviously, the treatment for schizophrenia didn't do me any good. I think we're in less primitive times now, but one thing I learned, number one, very few people are relieved to get a diagnosis of epilepsy because there is a stigma. But coming out of the stigma that went with schizophrenia, it was actually a relief. It was a lesser stigma. But the other thing is that it is possible for people to get mental conditions and neurological conditions confused, and some people have both. And some people may come to an organization like Transitions who have a neurological condition rather than a medical condition, and are they able to help or refer such people appropriately? And finally, on the level of stigma, I would like us to abandon words like schizophrenic and epileptic. There are people who deal with schizophrenia. There are people who deal with epilepsy. We don't call a person with cancer a canceratic. We don't call a person with flu a flutic. We're not talking about other species here. Always, we're talking about the conditions people deal with. And so, on the level of sensitivity, whoever, whatever condition they may have, it is a person with a condition, not a type of person. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. I appreciate that insight. And that was our last request to speak, so I'll close public comment. Ms. Robin, would you like to comment just briefly on the breadth of behavioral health and where, how neurologic issues fit in and might be diagnosed? There are presumably differentials that we deal with on those questions.
Sure. Remembering that I'm not a doctor, I'm just a lowly marriage and family therapist. But Mr. Greening is correct that in our past history, frequently people with Alzheimer's disorder who were deaf, who had neurological disorders, epilepsy, were incorrectly diagnosed as having a major mental illness. I think our field has come a long way in doing better at diagnostics. There are people who might have epilepsy and also who have suffered from schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. Certainly there are people who are what we call comorbid or even trimorbid, who may also have an addiction attached. So I appreciate Mr. Greening's comments. Also, we do not specifically treat somebody solely with a neurological disorder like epilepsy. We are contracted to provide the psychiatric disorder treatment, which is what we are skilled at, and then refer for neurological disorders to neurologists or other doctors who can take care of that part of the brain chemistry.
Very good. Thank you. On behalf of the board, let me thank you, Ms. Robin, Mr. Hamm, for pulling together these performance measures in the detail that you did. Again, I think this has been an excellent introduction to a wider conversation about behavioral health services. I look forward to that in the coming months. We are on the cusp of some, in the midst of some significant changes in the way we deliver, especially behavioral health services, with the Affordable Care Act and AB 109 changing a lot of paradigms that we deal with. So we thank you for your work. We look forward to further conversation. We are going to
Departments of Public Works approach over the next 12 months. Currently, as of August 5th, the county remains in a D4 exceptional drought rating intensity level. 82% of California remains at D3, which is extreme drought, or higher, with 58% of the state now in a D4. Statewide reservoir levels are dropping and groundwater is diminishing. The state's 154 reservoirs are now at 60% of historical averages, which is 17.3 million acre feet lower than normal. I wanted to provide this slide in order to provide a good picture of how the drought has intensified over the last 2 years. As you can see, the county of San Luis Obispo has remained at the highest severity level throughout the state. And looking ahead over the next year, rainfall is expected to be still relatively low. Last week, the Climate Prediction Center released a report decreasing the chance of an El Nino from 82% to now 65%. Locally, rainfall levels and reservoir levels remain low. Nos Camino is at 19% of capacity. Whale Rock and Lopez is at 50% of capacity. And Salinas is now at 29% of capacity. The red line indicates the historical average, where the blue bar indicates where currently capacity levels are. The drought continues to produce a complex web of impacts. Agricultural impacts continue to worsen, and the current agriculture producer survey indicated that another dry year would shift the crisis to a disaster. Forecasts indicate that there remains an above-normal large fire potential from July to October, and economic conditions continue to intensify. The agricultural industry is reporting having to lay off employees due to crop loss, and it's important to note the Department of Social Services continues efforts to collect job loss data, and employers are urged to contact the department if they're experiencing impacts due to the drought. The most recent action by the state was the State Water Resources Control Board emergency regulations. All Californians are expected to stop washing down driveways and sidewalks, watering of outdoor landscape that cause excess runoff, using a hose to wash motor vehicles unless the hose is fitted with a shutoff nozzle, and using potable water in a fountain unless water is recirculated. And water suppliers are required to activate water shortage contingency plans to a level where outdoor irrigation restrictions are mandatory. And if no plans exist, water suppliers must limit outdoor irrigation to twice a week or other comparable actions. And they also must report water use on a monthly basis. Water users can now be fined up to $500 a day for failure to implement conservation requirements, and water agencies that don't comply with the regulation can be subject to a $10,000 a day penalty. The County Drought Task Force continues to coordinate with local and state agencies. On July 17th, an immediate water shortage learning event was held with the Department of Water Resources, the State Water Quality Control Board, Cal OES, Cal Fire, and local cities and CSDs. Overall, the event was very successful in gathering information from all agencies in order to plan for a potential emergency situation. County Office of Emergency Services also continues to assist with emergency actions. County OES worked with Cal OES in communicating Cambria's assistance requested need for a petition for temporary urgency change to a monitoring well. County General Services also continues to work on reducing county usage. To date, 29 buildings have been retrofitted, saving 2,500 gallons of water per week. And the water audit report focusing on water efficiency is currently under review by the department. County staff is also continuing to develop plans to ensure there is adequate supply of water for drinking and firefighting. To date, data for 85 water systems have been placed into the GIS mapping layer. And lastly, the county continues to work on a variety of emergency options, including obtaining emergency water storage bladders as well as water trucking options, such as the ability to deliver water to coastal communities using a barge. I'm now going to hand it over to Mark Hutchinson with the Department of Public Works, and he's going to give an overview of the department's approach over the next year.
Mr. Hutchinson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Mark Hutchinson, Department of Public Works. I want to do just what we call a one-year look ahead and walk through the county from the perspective of the county itself as the operator of retail systems, wholesale systems, and in the Chorro Valley as a major water user. I want to talk briefly on a region-by-region basis of where we are, our current status, what sort of issues, water supply issues that we are dealing with in our own systems today, what sort of plans we have for the next. From a larger perspective, the biggest concern in the South County is the issue of groundwater use. We're seeing groundwater declines in the Santa Maria groundwater basin as far through Napomo and all the way up into the Rio Grande Oceano area. That affects our plans for Zone 3, our surface water distribution, because all of our Zone 3 customers, all but one set of Zone 3 customers are also groundwater users. So we're needing to operate Lopez Lake in a mode that offsets reduced groundwater pumping by the South County cities in order to avoid seawater intrusion impacts. We will see next Tuesday a hearing item on your board business item, to consider implementing what's called surplus water in the Zone 3 contracts. That's an unfortunate term because the water is not actually surplus. So we'll go into a lot more detail next week about what's happening with Zone 3 in the South County cities. From a plan perspective, the cities are developing something called a low reservoir response plan, which is already provided for in the operating agreements with Zone 3. And that will help to offset the future potential loss of state water supplies in 2016 and, again, address the seawater intrusion issue. From a concern standpoint, Lopez Lake also contributes significant downstream flows on an annual basis to the Rio Grande Valley, which recharges groundwater and also supplies agriculture, nearly directly supplies agriculture in the upper Rio Grande Valley. What we're looking at is an aerial picture looking, if we were directly above the city looking up at Lopez Lake, which is at the top of this picture, we can see the amount of agriculture in this part of the valley. These farmers do not have extensive groundwater supplies because of the shallow aquifer and depend almost entirely on there being surface flow in Arroyo Grande Creek. So as we look at potentially reducing deliveries to municipalities, there would be an equal or near equal reduction in downstream releases, and we are our long-term concern is how that affects the farmers in the valley. So to address that, our partners in the South County, along with the county itself, are working on this low reservoir response plan and are at a point where we're going to fully engage with the agricultural community and try to figure out how to manage those downstream releases next year and years following so that it has the least impact on agriculture that we can. But with a deepening drought, this may be one of the more significant areas that we start to see agricultural impacts. Moving to the coast area, the county itself provides treated water through what we call County Service Area 10 to most of Cayucas through a water treatment plant that draws water from Well Rock Reservoir. And then CSA 10A, a subset of that, is a retail system, the Morro Strand area in southern Cayucas, that the county is the actual water purveyor. Those systems are currently in good shape, system-wise and also water supply-wise. There's an adequate legal allocation from Well Rock Reservoir that predates the reservoir itself. Well Rock is at about 50% capacity, and although it's managed by the Well Rock Commission, they manage it in a way that certainly keeps Cayucas in mind. So over the next 12 months, we do not see significant issues with water supply in Cayucas and to county customers or the other water companies that are there. We're moving forward with pre-existing plans to add a water storage tank to the CSA 10A distribution system to provide additional resiliency from an infrastructure standpoint. And we'll, of course, apply the new state emergency requirements, the county ordinance that was introduced on today's agenda and will be a hearing item on the 19th as well. Concerns in the North County really go to other systems, primarily San Simeon and Cambria, both of which are in emergency status, both of which have emergency drought project applications in the queue and hopefully will be funded by the state. Our concern there is that as a water purveyor, the county, and back to this map, does not have any significant infrastructure in the San Simeon-Cambria area. The closest we get to those communities is our water treatment plant at Cayucas, which again in our drought emergency exercise is one of the considerations. So as you know, our planning department has worked diligently with both communities to shepherd their applications through the coastal permit process. And we continue to be in conversation with Cambria and San Simeon about their status, and your board has fully supported their drought emergency application. In the North County, the county is a retail water provider in Chandon and Santa Margarita. We're a wholesale provider through the Nacimiento Water Project, and we operate the Salinas Water Project, Santa Margarita Lake, on behalf of the city of San Luis Obispo. Our retail systems, CSA 16 and 23, from an infrastructure and water, or the more wholesale systems, the Salinas Water Project, Santa Margarita, continues to run as necessary for the city of San Luis Obispo. And then for the Nacimiento Water Project, as you are aware, it is currently shut down for repairs, trying to determine the extent of leakage, and working closely with the TSG, the technical support group, and the cities that are customers for that project. They're making strategic decisions about moving forward, again, with permanent repairs in lieu of trying to limp along for another couple of years with a leaking system. Plans for those areas, we're moving ahead with the community support with a state water connection for CSA 16, obviously a longer-term look ahead because we don't foresee significant state water being available, but the timing is right for that community to go ahead and make the physical connection. They've been a state water subcontractor since the inception of the project. And, of course, additional water conservation per the state requirements is coming down the road. From a concern standpoint, we are continuing to support Heritage Ranch. They also have an emergency drought application before the board, the state board, to make a direct connection to the Nacimiento Water Project infrastructure below the dam to be able to draw water from their Nacimiento Lake allocation should Monterey County have to reduce downstream flows. I should say that we work closely with Monterey County, all of the Nacimiento Water Project agencies and Salinas agencies to support their decision to reduce their downstream releases in the face of some minor objections from federal resource agencies. But they continue to monitor the effects of reducing their downstream by more than half in order to preserve water in the lake so that they could continue to make downstream releases, although at a lesser rate. Our biggest concern, obviously, in the North County is the situation with the Paso Robles groundwater basin. From a public works perspective, we are aware that there is some 6,000 acre-feet of unallocated water in the reservoir. If not used by San Luis Obispo County, it goes downstream in the Nacimiento River and Salinas River and to Monterey County, which I'm sure they're appreciative of. But it does not provide any benefit to our citizens in the Paso Robles groundwater basin area. So we continue to work on the plans and studies that the board has already put us towards, the supply option study, the modeling update, and all of that is predicated on the information that's been developed over the last few years on that basin and how it works and the status of it. But at this point in time, we have a very minor ability to actually move physical water from that reservoir to people in need. City of Paso Robles and Atascadero Mutual Water Company have both taken action to amend their guidelines and regulations. They are both positioned to provide potable water to water haulers out of their systems. Remember that Nacimiento water is raw water. So they are actually treating that water through their systems, and they're positioned and may have already written contracts with water haulers so that they can move essentially Nacimiento water out to folks with dry wells who otherwise need potable water on their properties in the Paso Robles Basin area. State water is its own animal. Current deliveries are at 5% of allocation. Many of our agencies, our state water subcontractors, are currently operating on their 5% plus what's called carryover water in that system. Agencies have the ability to essentially bank water in the San Luis Reservoir and then use it at a later time. We have been engaging state water subcontractors very recently to get their opinions and their thoughts and ideas on a delivery plan for next year. And I'll just put this table up, talk about it a little bit. This is slightly revised from what's in your staff report because I was trying to simplify it. I don't know that I did a very good job, but also this is an ever-evolving effort. To show you our situation, in the blue column, it says Table A amount, and that's just the basic amount of water that each subcontractor has contracted for. That totals 4,830 acre feet. The column I took out because it's confusing is called drought buffer. So we need to understand that our subcontractors have contracted for a pipeline that will deliver 4,830 acre feet, plus a little bit. Out of the 25,000 acre feet that the county itself has owned from the State Water Project for decades. Some of those agencies, but not all, have also purchased what's called drought buffer water. In a couple of cases, as much as three times their Table A amount. So they don't have pipeline capacity because the county owns the rights to the remaining difference between the Table A carryover and 25,000 acre foot allocation. There in the green, we estimate that on January 1st, the district itself, the county, will own 2,256 acre feet of water that sits in San Luis Reservoir and is available for the district to deliver. At that point, we look at a couple of scenarios. The reasonable worst case scenario with continuation of the drought at its current depth and extent would say that the State Water Project next year will deliver somewhere between 5% and 0% of the Table A amount. We looked at that and said, well, we do not have enough water, the 2256, to make everybody whole, but it seems prudent at this point to deliver that water to our customers based on need, looking at their entire water portfolio, and also looking ahead to a 2016 with no state water at all, and what our options might be to move emergency water supplies around the county in our existing systems. So I guess if I could go back to the question of reasonable worst case, the first part is zero deliveries in 2015 and in 2016, so now I'm looking ahead 2 years. Although some agencies may still have water in storage, the reasonable worst case is that the State Water Project will shut down because of a lack of water to actually run it, not enough water in the canal to keep the canal moving, and potential water quality issues, water bad enough that it can't be treated in our local treatment plants for domestic use. As an aside, we're seeing a little foretaste of that even now. There are some taste and odor issues with state water due to algae blooms in the system, and we've been informed that chloride levels are starting to rise in the state water supply as well, so diminishing water quality. But the parameters of no state water next year and a system that doesn't run in 26 years both argue for the county moving as much, and our subcontractors, as much stored water out of San Luis Reservoir as we can next year into San Luis Obispo County. And so the table that you see up there is what results, the projected deliveries in 2015 in the yellow column. We've sent this out to all of our subcontractors. We're starting to get their comments and thoughts back. Our intent is to have a North County or a Chorro Valley turnout meeting and also a Lopez turnout meeting and possibly get everybody together in a follow-up meeting. A couple of the agencies have already ask questions about our basic underlying assumptions that I just gave, and most of them are in agreement that that's a reasonable planning scenario, although it will need to adjust depending on this year's precipitation through the winter.
Before we leave that, Mr. Hutchinson, I wonder if I could just ask a question. So, mashing through the numbers here, you're suggesting that we may strand 1,258 feet of water up in San Luis Reservoir because we are not planning to deliver it, as according to the yellow column here.
Yes.
Is it possible to move that 1,258 into the county and park it somewhere? Lopez Lake, Santa Margarita Lake, someplace where a pipe would otherwise be able to deposit it?
Well, from looking at the pipes and where the plumbing goes, we have the ability to, in effect, store water in Lopez Lake for later delivery to the state water customers that are connected at the Lopez turnout. So the one agency, interesting, the agencies that have numbers in the remaining column are the first ones to pick up the phone and call. Mm-hmm. We see San Miguelito Mutual Water Company, which is in the Avila Beach area and uses the Lopez system for delivery of their water. There are already conversations amongst the South County agencies and San Miguelito as how best to deal with that 265 acre-feet of potentially stranded water. You also note that their Table A amount is 275. We projected 130 acre-feet deliveries because that's typically what they request in an average year. So San Miguelito, I've had conversations with their manager, is trying to determine whether they should back off their groundwater, their alternate supply, and go with more state water this year. And the question there is, how reliable is groundwater that they leave in the ground? Will it be there, or is it all flowing down gradient and away from their system? They're talking with other Lopez agencies about trading state water for Lopez water next year and then leaving that in the lake, or should they store their own state water in the lake? And if they do, is there an evaporation loss, and is there a retreatment? So all of these
number of the engineering issues. I guess the question is your department played with the options to see if we absolutely maximize
Coral Bay? I know that their public works folks are still digesting this. And the instant, the first decision an agency has to make is, do they believe the state water project will shut down in 2016? Or are they in a position where they need to take the risk that it will run and that they could get direct deliveries? And looking out 2 years, that's a difficult decision.
I understand. Supervisor Arnold may have a question.
My question's along the lines of Chairman Gibson's. So that carryover water, if we could bring it and put it in our own facility, Lopez Lake, when can we do that? Do we have to wait, or could we do it like immediately, for example? That carryover water, we'll take it over here, please. We'll take care of it ourselves for the next several months, so that you have it secured. What does that look like?
Yeah, all of those things go to infrastructure issues, pumping capability, treatment capability, working with CCWA, and then even when we get it in Lopez, we deliver in a maximum weekend. Our Lopez distribution system has a treatment plant that's running above its rated capacity in addition to treated state water. So if we put it all in Lopez, we can't deliver it at the peak rates that we can now. So all of these conversations ongoing with the customers.
It's just it feels like having it in our own reservoir versus having it in the state system secures at least it's here. And then, you're talking about very worst case scenario. So next year, if we're delivering on a state water shutdown, then the potential to talk to City of San Luis or other places where there are treatment plants and capacity to move water, et cetera. I mean, that could be a later conversation. I think what you were getting at is having our water in our own reservoir.
The problem being, I don't think there's a pipe that takes state water and dumps it into Lopez. We have to use state water and not use Lopez water in effect park it, is my understanding of the system.
Well, that's the way it would work in the South County. You're not storing the same molecules, but amounts.
But the concept is exactly that. We need to maximize, against the worst case scenario, we need to maximize the utilization of our resource. And so I'm just probing with Mr. Hutchinson, and I understand the complexity. I appreciate the discussions are ongoing.
Yeah, and I just had one other thing. When you talk about maximizing capacity, a choice between losing our 6,000 acre feet out of Nasi at the end of this year or whenever that happens. When we don't use it, it kind of reverts back into the, not our system, but a different system. And we've discussed it earlier, months ago, but the ability to, and I know there's a pumping cost, but it seems like maybe it would be worth it this year, pumping back down to Atascadero and putting it in the Salinas and letting it move up towards Paso where it could alleviate groundwater pumping. I mean, it's better than losing it altogether and being able to see if that would help recharge the groundwater.
That's one of those, and we'll talk about Nacimiento and Chorro Valley and all of those.
Okay, but that's a simple
thing. We've been talking with the TSG about those options and their experiences. Mm-hmm. It turns out that one of the agencies several years ago made a deal with the city of San Luis Obispo to release additional water from Santa Margarita Lake mm-hmm. downstream in an effort to essentially raise the underflow levels through Atascadero and Paso Robles.
Mm-hmm.
It's either Atascadero or Templeton that was involved in that. And there was, you know, excess water. Their result was not, encouraging?
But it was my understanding at that time we were talking about 1,000 acre feet being released down at the, from the Salinas Dam and having to move north. This would be 6,000 released potentially at Atascadero, where it's so much closer. I mean, it's just another.
Yeah, and it's part of the it's part of our efforts to look at how the basin works, because the Salinas River, as far as Paso Robles groundwater basin in our county, tends to be at the lowest point.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a sense that additional flows in the river don't necessarily address groundwater basin issues out in the Jardine area and farther up. We look at the number of people who are pumping from the Salinas River corridor. Of course, they're at the bottom of the basin, so they have wells that operate.
Yeah.
So the efficiency of all of that is very much in question.
As long, and you all will be looking at this, I'm sure, but where the Cone of Depression is, which is exactly where we're talking about, where Paso has the shallow wells and the deeper wells at Estrella, that if something like that kind of recharge at the only as far south as the Atascadero area, or the Salinas right there above Atascadero, could affect or relieve the city of Paso from having to pump as much. I know it wouldn't affect the folks out, you know, as you move.
A couple of things, Mark, talking about putting, and I agree with my colleagues in terms of trying to utilize whatever we have available to us from the state standpoint, but if you bring state water in, that's treated water out of Colonial Pass. So you can't just dump that in any reservoir without, I guess, getting the chlorine out of it. That same issue applies to Kachuma, from what I understand. So we've got infrastructure. We've got storage issues. What is the possibility of, I guess, expanding our storage capabilities by dredging some of the areas that are dry? From what I understand, Santa Margarita's got an awful lot of siltation due to the past fires, things like that. As opposed to building something, could we expand on our reservoir capacity by doing something like that?
That would have to be a case by case, just to look at not only the cost of reservoir dredging and everything that goes along with it, but also trying to understand from reservoir to reservoir where the sediment is, how often that affects the storage capability of the reservoir. I'll give you an example. The one I know most about is Lopez Lake. We know that we have sediment behind the dam, so all the way down in the bottom of the reservoir. We know that it's below the minimum pool level. So, you know, once you hit minimum pool, or as they used to call it, dead pool, it doesn't really matter whether it's water or mud. It's water that's not accessible. Now, when you get into some rather extreme contingency plans, it becomes an issue. But the other amount of sediment that's in Lopez Reservoir is in the upper reaches of the creeks that feed the lake, and you can see that with the lake dam. So it's it only affects reservoir capacity when the lake is nearly full, because that sediment flows downstream, hits a full lake in a wet year, and then drops out, lays up in those creeks. So the idea that we could dredge out a certain amount of sediment in cubic yards and then produce an acre foot additional storage. For one, it's very expensive, but it turns out that most of the time the additional storage we create is in places in the reservoir that would not have water in it in a drought period anyway. For like Lopez, there's a significant amount of sediment that's above the, say, 45,000 acre foot in storage. When the lake's at, it's a 50,000 acre foot reservoir. When it's at 45,000 acre foot, that's typically an average year, and there's just nowhere to use the water.
And do we have any access at all to any type of the pipeline infrastructure that's out there? For example, I know that there's a couple of pipelines that go from San Luis to Avila that were oil pipelines that are no longer used, 12 inch and an 8 inch. Could those be sleeved and used for transmission at some point if the county were to be able to acquire those pipelines?
I would think that at this point we haven't looked deeply into that, which is why this is a one-year look ahead. But as we continue to plan a year ahead, month over month over month, and especially if this drought continues for another year, I think at this point next year we'll be looking at all kinds of interesting options.
Thank you. Very good. Thank you. Thank you for the detailed examination, Mr. Coaches.
I wanted to just finish up, probably not necessary to point out that I put that chart up there to illustrate some of the complexities of this kind of planning. We got that at first. Choro Valley, I wanted to mention that because the county, we're a state water purveyor there, but there's all kinds of water systems running in and around Choro Valley and all those institutions. Our primary interest there is as a water consumer. You can see that we've got the government center, Cuesta College, Camp San Luis, county schools, California Men's Colony as the major users of water out there, and then there's some other smaller institutions that operate in and amongst those. The Choro Valley is highly dependent on state water for a number of reasons, but also has very limited groundwater supply and access to well rock supplies. To deal with the potential of reduced state water, we formulated a couple of preliminary plans. We've also formed a Choro Valley Working Group, so we have all of the agencies involved talking on a regular basis, weekly conference calls to try to deal with big issues and small issues, build relationships, try to understand capabilities of various systems. Infrastructure issues in the Choro Valley are very complex. We have state water being delivered to some of the institutions and not others. The Salinas Pipeline comes into the Choro Valley. Remnants of the World War II system, for instance, the CMC water treatment plant that treats well rock, which was constructed to treat Salinas, is a 1940s water treatment plant that's had fairly good maintenance, but no significant upgrades that they treat, which is about double what they did last year and this year, but the operators believe their plant can do it. We would hope then that next year, with carryover state water, the additional well rock, and conservation, the Choro Valley institutions would be able to operate. Cuesta College is not going to look good from a landscape perspective, I can say that. Then the intertie hopefully would be under construction, although in 2016, and again I'm getting out there with this, we would hope to not use the intertie. Oddly enough, it would become an infrastructure backup system. And I can point back to the Nacimiento Water Project, one of our newer systems, which is down for repairs. So across the county, we're looking at one of our public works type concerns is that we're getting down to communities operating on a single system, dependent on a single water treatment plant, a single well, a single pipe. But in the Choro Valley, year two, with state water not being delivered, local supplies diminishing, no carryover state water, we would ask CMC to treat additional well rock water and exchange well rock for Nacimiento water via the city of San Luis Obispo. So city of San Luis, instead of using well rock, would use more Nacimiento water paid for by the Choro Valley institutions, and CMC would treat that water. And the point of that is to be able to efficiently run the two water treatment plants. When you talk to treatment plant operators, if we talk about mixing multiple sources of supply in the same pipe into the same water treatment plant, they start to quiver because it causes water treatment issues, and you can run into water quality problems. And then that pushes us all the way out to 2017 in the extreme, you know, three more years of drought, levels of conservation that right now we haven't figured out how to achieve, but then a small amount of nacimiento water having to go through the intertie to CMC because well rock supplies are down to where we'd be endangering potentially Cayucas and or the city of San Luis Obispo and Cal Poly. So it starts to spread the levels of complexity, the number of agreements, the number of plans and contingencies that have to be made all along while depending on a maximum level of conservation. So Chorro Valley starts to illustrate the number of folks that are involved in our planning, the number of people we're talking to, the long-term plans, all of which have to be flexible and change with rainfall and state water deliveries as things change. From a public works perspective, then we're also following, as you know, legislation and regulation. You've heard about the State Water Resources Control Board emergency water conservation requirements and their regulations. We've introduced an ordinance this morning. We'll have that hearing next Tuesday to consider the outdoor watering restrictions in county systems. We by no means believe that the State Water Control Board or DWR is done making emergency regulations. Although we haven't seen any on the horizon, we expect that they will continue to be developed and passed down to us. On the legislation front, we're following the two groundwater bills, Pedley and Dickinson, as to their effect on the county. That's more of a long-term planning issue, but things that our partners in the north, south, and central part of the county are all anxious to start moving forward on. And I'm informed that there's proposed legislation for the water bond, potentially for November ballot, that we need to delve into and see what that means for our county. So we have our long-term water planning folks and our admin folks also hard at work on drought issues. With that, if there are other questions, we'll try to answer those, both Lisa and I together.
Thank you. At the end of your staff's presentation, appreciate that. I don't see any immediately from the dais here. Let me open it to the public. We have three requests to speak. We'll start with Eric Greening, followed by Mary Lucy.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and it was interesting to hear some beginning discussions about how decisions would be made about what water will move from where to where with the Chorro Valley intertie. It's clear that, barring a miracle, between now and next April, no nacimiento water will be moving anywhere due to the repairs in that situation, which means that there is time to actually do that project right, even in its initial scoping and environmental review. There was a deadline for comments on the negative declaration. I don't know from whom or how many comments came in. I know I made some comments. I do not believe it's a valid negative declaration. I would like to ask, and primarily based on a couple of check marks that were misplaced, and you probably are privy to that correspondence. I don't want to go into those details now. I simply wanted to ask Marbles on a negative declaration that can't hold water. Anyway, that's one issue, and a lot of the other issues will be dealt with in future hearings that are going to be scheduled in front of your board, but I've heard nothing about the hearing process for this negative declaration. I would like to hear a date and just some of the follow-up actions on that. I'm not taking it for granted that the project is, as currently scoped, is the project that's going to happen, but if it does, I certainly think we need a better understanding of the decision-making process under which water would be moved to benefit certain entities at the expense of and with impacts on other entities. Thank you,
Mr. Greening. Ms. Lucy, followed by Bill Pelfrey.
Good afternoon. My name is Mary Lucy. I sit on the board of directors for the Oceanic Community Services District. Mr. Ogram would have been here himself, but I have him working on some county stuff right now, but he assured us he'll be here next week. So I used to say that teasingly. I wanted to let you know that the Board of Directors has sent you a letter taking a position and supporting the recommendations that are now being slowly or coming together. And so we did want to get a communication out to your body to let you know where we stood. I was a very strong advocate against releasing the surplus water, just for the sense that it really wasn't surplus. And so I think that there's been some clarification. The County Department of Planning has recommended a collaboration with the bodies that are impacted in the South County area, particularly under the basin and the Lopez. We strongly encourage that dialogue to start. It should have started much longer. If our primary goal is to correct the groundwater basin, we have to start, we have to at least begin to have people start putting numbers on paper. When Oceano was at a threat of saltwater intrusion, and that's exactly what it was, a threat, we immediately stopped pumping. And as the smallest partner in the South County, we've made larger contributions than everybody compiled together. We have given up almost 90% of our groundwater basin so far for the last 6 years, and we've suffered for it. And now we have our state water 95% cutback. So, but over the last 20 years, I have to say is that the little town has stayed, kept their eye on the ball, has done an excellent job in diversifying their water portfolio. It's looked at on a state level, and we may not look the prettiest and the cleanest, but we do have a strong water portfolio. And we realized very early on in our founding fathers that that meant our independence. And so to date, we were able to hold a little bit of sense of community by securing these services. And so we just wanted to take a moment to let you know that Mr. Ogren will be here next week, and we do support the direction that the county's moving in. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lucy. Mr. Pelfrey.
Bill Pelfrey, Templeton. Quick note on the Monday-Thursday watering. You might want to change that to one day of the weekend, such as Thursday-Sunday, because that's when people can repair their things and see what's going on. If you do it during the week, there's usually nobody there. It makes no sense. I see Mr. Gibson's inner tie is laced in here very well, but it doesn't. We still haven't done the map of the dry areas. I think if we do that for the Knox Mineral Basin, we'll see that most of the dry wells, which we still don't know how many are where, are in actually lenses or rock pools. And that makes a big difference when planning for a drought. You have to know where the water is, where it's not. Some reason we can't get that done. There have been no plans on how to harvest water to help this drought. I haven't seen anything, and yet on December 18, 2012, I brought forward the idea of bladder dams to this board. Simple, inexpensive, harvests water. No talk about it. And the documents for the model update, even with your adding your 2 years of 12-13, is still not out. I understand it will be certainly soon, but you've had 2 years to doctor that, in my opinion, and all it's going to do is show the conditions of the drought without knowing where the drought is actually handling the North County. Now, these interdates, why can't we do it and keep it ourselves? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pelfrey. That was our last request to speak, so I'll bring it back to the board. Not seeing any further requests from my colleagues on questions or comments. With that, then, we'll thank staff for this and appreciate in particular the detailed analysis of public works. This is a receive and file only on this report, and so we will look forward to next steps. With that, we come to closed session, which is going to be conducted today. I have no requests to speak, and seeing no one coming forward, I'll close to the public and ask counsel for an estimate, please.
Yes, Rita Neal, County Council, about 30 minutes today.
Very good. We will reconvene at 1:30. Madam Clerk,
your microphones are live.
Thank you for that warning. We are reconvened at 1:30. Council, a report out of closed session, please.
Yes, Rita Neal, County Council. The board did meet in closed session, and no reportable action was taken.
Thank you very much. I'd entertain a motion then on our presentation calendar.
So moved.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. And Ms. Ray, Madam Clerk, a roll call, please.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes.
Ms. Ray.
Yes.
Mr. Meacham.
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Arnold.
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
You didn't
sure.
yet.
I didn't say
you didn't
it first.
Yet.
I'm sorry about that.
I'm fine. You didn't.
Yes. All right. And so, I don't have my agenda immediately in front of me, but I do believe that you're up first, Mr. Hill?
Nope.
No. It's the...
Ms. Ray, then.
It's Mr. Leno.
That shows what
we're
level of
session,
the leadership. We haven't been in closed session in a long time, and council confused me. So,
it's Dustin.
I am pleased to be reading a resolution commending Dustin Leno for achieving the prestigious honor and distinction of accredited airport executive. So I don't
come
know
to the come to the lecture.
I can properly embarrass
and
you.
Accept this.
Thank you.
Excellent. The following resolution is hereby offered in read. Whereas San Luis Obispo County airports represent both a significant economic asset to the county and surrounding region and provide an integral component of transportation for the county, and whereas Dustin Leno is an airport operations supervisor with the General Services Agency, Airports, a position to which he was appointed in August 2007, and whereas the American Association of Airport Executives encourages airport executives to enrich their airport experience through an accreditation program, which requires the candidate to test their knowledge and skills in the many facets of airport management, and whereas Dustin Leno completed the rigorous requirements of the accreditation program and demonstrated initiative, commitment, dedication, knowledge, skill, and stamina, attributes admired, applauded, and recognized by his peers in the many elements of the aviation industry, and whereas Dustin Leno joins a select group of individuals who have earned the Accredited Airport Executive, AAE, designation over the past 60 years of the accreditation program's existence, and whereas General Services Agency, Airports, is extremely proud of Dustin Leno's accomplishment and wish him continued success, and now therefore be it resolved in order by the Board of Supervisors that Dustin Leno, AAE, Airport Operations Supervisor, is hereby commended for his achievement of the distinction of Accredited Airport Executive.
Pick up the hardware. If we want to do a photo op, if that's Mrs. Leno in the back,
come here and welcome. We'll let Kevin take a picture with you.
Yes. and Dustin up here.
She's so proud of you.
Yeah.
Come over here. Dustin, come over here.
We're gonna make you look really good.
Yeah.
Come over. Whatever. Come.
Okay. You guys make us look good.
Yeah.
There you go.
Are you an official ambassador?
That's right. Yeah, really. Yeah, that's right. Mr. Buman?
I wanted to personally congratulate Dustin on this accomplishment. In the airports industry, this is the PhD in airports. It's a distinction that very few in the industry receive. It's been around for about 60 years. And Dustin, I've had the pleasure of working with him for the last 10 months. He is an incredible asset to our team. I would also point out he's a fellow pilot. And for those of us that manage airports, having real experience in the aircraft when you're managing an airport is absolutely invaluable. So I have really enjoyed the time we've worked together and look forward.
And mothers who are successful at meeting their breastfeeding goals are more likely to be surrounded by a supportive team of family, friends, and coworkers, employers, healthcare providers, child care providers, and other members of the community. And communities which create such positive and supportive environments reap the benefits of healthier babies and mothers, a more productive workforce, improved household finances, and empowered women. and fostering the development of communities with health and dignity, especially for mothers and children, is the vision of Millennium Development Goals of the United Nations. And whereas World Breastfeeding Month 2014 celebrates the vital role of Team Breastfeed in helping families achieve their breastfeeding goals with the theme Breastfeeding, a Winning Goal for Life, and whereas all citizens are urged to join Team Breastfeed and cheer on the efforts of mothers, babies, and families, now therefore be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby proclaim August 2014 as World Breastfeeding Awareness Month in our San Luis Obispo County. So Ingrid, could you come up?
Supervisors?
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to hear
say
about
a few
that.
Words.
You and I don't
please.
We have a.
I just wanted to thank the board for allowing us to come down here to celebrate a wonderful month with your ongoing support for a great cause and program, the French Hospital Medical Center Breastfeeding Clinic and its lactation consultants are able to provide excellent quality, compassionate care to our low-income moms and other breastfeeding moms within the county. So thank you for your time and letting us come down here and celebrate this time.
Ms. Rodriguez, thank you. As the board's representative to the First Five Commission, I know that that entity invests in French and other programs to get breastfeeding going, and we know it pays big benefits. So
is, yeah.
We thank you
so
for
thank you
and the
much.
Caring folks who do all that good work.
Thank you very
Thanks.
Much. Appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
All right. That said, Madam Clerk, our next item, please.
Certainly. That would be item 36. Submittal of bid opening report for the Juvenile Hall Expansion Project located at 1065 Kansas Avenue, San Luis Obispo. And contingent on State Department of Finance approval, 1, award the subject contract to Deani Building Corp. in the amount of $15,277,000, 2, authorize budget adjustments for the project totaling $16,787,364 to Fund Center 230 capital projects, including $2,939,885 of new county funding. 3, authorize the General Services Agency Director or her designee to order construction changes or additions within the limits set by the Public Contract Code. 4, authorize the Auditor Controller, Treasurer, Tax Collector to support cash flow requirements for the project. 5, authorize the Auditor Controller, Treasurer, Tax Collector to execute and amend certificate of other participating county funding if required by the state. And 5, to receive a project update, District 2.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. Mr. Salio, are you leading us in this effort?
I am. Jim Salio, Chief Probation Officer. Good afternoon, members of the board. Today we're here to update the board on the Juvenile Expansion Project and talk about our next steps. We're at a very important crossroad in our long journey to expand our juvenile hall. Journey that began back in 2008 as we saw a need in the future to provide more infrastructure and services within the juvenile hall to extend, improve an existing building that was built in the early 1980s to meet the needs of our current population and the population moving forward into the future. As you recall, the expansion project included building much-needed administrative offices, both for our supervising staff at the hall as well as for our therapists and counselors at the hall, to build classrooms for the juvenile hall. When the juvenile hall was originally built, it had one classroom that was soon incorporated into a dining room and then later into offices. To expand our housing unit to add 20 beds, which would allow us to take an existing unit offline and make a much-needed treatment program to treat the juveniles that we're currently sending all over the state of California for treatment, be able to treat them here in our community. And finally, to build a multi-purpose gym, which would allow for large muscle activity and other activities outside the building in inclement weather. So all these things were things that we needed back in 2008 and things we still need today and I'm certain we'll need into the future. Part of the benefits of this project.
Good afternoon, Board of Supervisors. I'm Tully Wyatt, Supervisor for Architectural Services. I'll give you a current status of the project. Our bids were received on June 5th, and they came in at $15.2 million, which exceeded the project budget by $2.9 million. Although we have not been able to contact the bidding contractors to this point, through the bid RFI process, we kind of gleaned some reasons that the bids came in higher. Those would be incorrect assumptions in the estimate, clarifications to window fire rating systems, galvanization of the helical pier foundation system, data storage requirements, and custom security fencing. We also gleaned that there was higher risk due to poor soils conditions. The area is a silt plain, so we have an extensive helical pier foundation system similar to what's going in at the women's jail. At the women's jail, the helical piers have taken longer than they expected, and we expect that some of that risk has been factored into those bids for the juvenile hall. We also saw that a lot of the contractors, the general contractors before that bid the project, had numerous subcontractors that they listed, so there was a limited bid pooling of subcontractors available. Since June 5th, staff has been engaged in an exercise to review options for the board's consideration. We've talked extensively with the state agencies, BSCC and CDCR, to find out what our options were at this point moving forward. Staff has vetted the options internally, and we're here to provide our best recommendation to the board. We have four options for your consideration, and each option will be analyzed on scope, schedule, and budget. Before I move forward with the four options, I just kind of want to give a brief description of what the term scope means. It means two different things as we move forward. There's the scope of the project, which is the plan specifications, right down to the color of paint on the walls, the carpet, and the door hardware. And then there's the scope document that is approved with the state, which is our agreement with the state on the major items that will be in the project. So it kind of means two different things, and as we go through each option, I'll kind of explain that so that it's kind of clear for each one of you. Option number one is to fully fund and award the project, and the impact that has to the scope, both the scope for the project and the scope for the state document, is none. We would proceed with construction as is per the approved plans and specifications. The impact of the schedule would also be none. If the board chooses to award the project today, we would move forward with going to the state for award in October and anticipate construction beginning in November of this year. And the impact of the budget is obviously major. We're $2.9 million short based on the bids we received, so it would require the county to fund an additional $2.9 million. Option number two would be to reject the bids and redesign within the state-approved scope document. The impacts here are moderate to scope, and the reason they're moderate is because we went through extensive VE before we put the project out to bid. So to stay within the scope document and make changes, there's really limited opportunities to do so, and there's not really high dollar value items in there that we can pick up.
And just to be clear, redesign the project to relook at the value engineering, that was your VE?
In this option, we would be limited to, let me explain a little bit better, I think. The state scope involves major items like the indoor gymnasium, multipurpose room, the classrooms, the housing unit, and the administration areas, the covered walkway. It involves square footage numbers that we agreed with the state. Any items that we decide to change through this redesign option would have to keep those things intact. Right. So we could change, you know, finishes, we could change from carpet to marmoleum, we could change paint colors on walls. The state doesn't really care about those things. If we went to changing, you know, eliminating classrooms or changing the size, reducing square footage, the state's going to step in and say, well, you've gone too far. Impact to the schedule with this option is moderate. We expect a minimum of a 6 to 9 month delay in moving the project forward. And that would include plan revisions, state review, BSCC, CDCR, state fire marshal, county review and approval to bid, putting the project back out to bid, and then coming back and getting award, and then going back through the state processes to award. and the impact of the budget would be major. Required county funding may exceed the $2.9 million because there's limited opportunities to go back into the documents at this point. We're spending time and effort and money while we're delaying the project, so we're seeing increased cost in administration of the contract, in escalation, inflation, and the bid environment is changing. We're seeing labor and material costs escalating right now. Option number three would be to revise the scope with the state and perform a full redesign. That means going back to the very beginning of the project and basically creating a new agreement with the state on what's going to be. And option number four would be to reject bids and cancel the project. And all the impacts here would be major. We would obviously not see a new facility for probation, so their current needs would remain unmet. The schedule would be major. There's no date set for a new facility or even a concept of when we could restart the project. And the budget would be major impact as well. We'll lose $13.1 million in state funding, and we'll receive no benefit from the sunk cost of $1.9 million that the county's already put into the project to get to this point. In addition, there's no guarantee of future state funding. My conversations with the state, there's another round of SB 81 funding available starting next spring. The total dollar value for that funding available is only $25 million, and the maximum award out of that for any one county of our size would be $12.5 million. So already that's less money than we've been awarded for the project to date. And there's no guarantee that would be a competitive process, so there's no guarantee we'd receive any of that money in the future. The state has also seen an improving economy in which architects, CM, and contractors are all seeing escalating costs. So even if we were awarded that full $12.5 million in another round of funding, it would not go nearly as far as what we have today. So to recap the project options, we have fully fund and award the project, or reject all bids and proceed with redesign within the state scope document, revise the full design of the project, or cancel the project. We've put together a side-by-side comparison of the impacts, just kind of recap what we walked through for each one of the options. Option one, no impact to scope and schedule, major impact to budget. Option two, moderate impact to scope and schedule, major impact to budget. Options three and four, incur major impacts to each of the categories. Staff's recommendation today is that the board fully fund and award the project. The option one impacts are shown, recapped above. Scope and schedule, no impact. Budget is a major impact. But the major benefits to taking option one are that probation receives their much-needed facility upgrade. Also, the county utilizes all of the $13.1 million in state funding. The facility will come online in 2016, which is the quickest in any of the options available. And also, local contractors are in line for work on the project. I'll turn it back over to Jim.
So I realize that coming back to the board asking for $2.9 million is a lot, but I still believe this is a worthwhile project in doing and a much-needed project for the infrastructure of the county of San Luis Obispo. As you can see from the pictures on the slide, the first picture is our day room, and our day room serves as our classroom, our dining room, our recreation room. It's a one-size-fits-all room, which makes it very difficult, especially for providing classroom education. Our teachers at the school there do a fantastic job working in that environment, but I think it would be a much better environment for kids if they were in a real classroom that looked like a classroom in any school. That's what this new design, the expansion, will provide. I think not having a classroom opens the county up for liability, educational lawsuits, et cetera, for not providing adequate learning environment, especially for most of the youth at Juvenile Hall, which have learning disabilities and are currently under individualized educational programs. The second piece, the second slide there, is a picture of a counselor counseling youth at the Juvenile Hall. They have to do this in a hallway because there is no place for counseling. Most of the kids we have at Juvenile Hall have emotional needs, severe emotional needs. And our counselors there do a fantastic job with the space they're provided, but they have to try to find a room in the hallway, a visiting room when it's not being occupied, any little nook and cranny they can find to meet with the kids. And this is a big problem, one that we've not been able to rectify without having the expanded space. Then we have the staff of the juvenile hall. The staff of the juvenile hall have one of the most difficult jobs, I think, in the county, working with some of the most challenging youth in a very confined environment, having to follow all the rules and regulations of the state of California, plus remembering that they are children and they are protected as children. This is the staff supervisor's office. This is when I started first working at the juvenile hall. This was a meeting room that had one desk in it. Now we have three desks for supervisors. They don't have private space to meet with the staff that's needed. They don't get to do their one-on-one meetings with staff that really is required. In fact, it's so cumbersome that many times we wanted to do a treatment program in the juvenile hall. We do not have a treatment program in the juvenile hall. We need a treatment program there. We just don't have the space to do it. By expanding on the juvenile hall and adding those 20 beds, we can provide a treatment program there. We can bring back youth that we have placed as far away as Humboldt County and Shasta County to bring them back into our community, closer to their families, so they can receive the counseling they need and they can work with their families and we can get them home faster. It's something that we've been needing for a long time, and this is an opportunity to offer it. And that's really the reason that I'm most excited and think this project is the most needed, is the fact that, you know, we need to be able to treat the kids that we have in our community and not have to ship them all over the state of California. And this will allow us to do this. Absent that, I don't see that being able to happen in our juvenile home. So I'll have Tali kind of recap the financial breakdown of the juvenile hall.
Sure. The slide shows the project financial breakdown. It shows us starting with the state SB 81 funding of $13.1 million. The county was required to provide an in-kind match, and that was $1.3 million. And the additional county funding required for the project was $6.8 million for a project total of $21.3 million. And that project total is based on the bids that were received. Previous county funding that had been allocated was $3.9 million. And so to move the project forward, we would need an additional $2.9 million in funding. Staff has come up with the plan to provide that funding as follows. $1.39 million of that would come from GSA, IT, and probation projects that would be deferred. Those projects could be deferred and resubmitted through the CIP process. And then $1.54 million would come from the general government building replacement designation. And option one, moving forward, the schedule would be a Board of Supervisors action today, and then contract award by Department of Finance would be October. Notice to proceed and mobilization would begin in November, with the juvenile hall substantially complete and operational in September of 2016.
So if the board, in conclusion, if the board today decides to adopt staff's recommendation, the county will have a juvenile hall that will last well into the future. The juvenile hall will be able to meet the needs of the youth of this community and better serve those needs. As a chief probation officer, one of my primary obligations is to provide a safe, humane environment to incarcerate juveniles. And I truly believe that they need a place that's an environment where they can learn, be nurtured, and learn to not come back into the justice system and hopefully not become adults in the criminal justice system. I think the chance for a treatment program, I think the chance for enhanced classroom space will provide that opportunity. We are not going to get another chance to get state money to build anything for a juvenile hall. From the environment in the state of California and where the money's going as far as juvenile treatment and those kind of things, I do not see money coming to counties for construction. We're the last of the funding for construction. $13.1 million back in 2008 when we applied for this award, seemed like a lot of money. Seemed like we could do it in that amount. We didn't know that it would take 7 years of delays and stalls, partly on the county's part and partly on the state's part, to move this project forward. The counties that have moved it forward, they all finished under budget. The ones that have waited, they're coming in over budget. It's just the environment of the time. But I still think for a total investment of $7 million in county funds, we are getting a lot more than we could ever get by just using straight county dollars. The things we need are going to cost us far more to build than what we're spending right now for all the things we need. So I think this is a great opportunity for the county, and I think we have to put more money up than we thought, but I think in the end we're going to get what we need, and we're still going to get a good deal in the process. So with that, I'll turn it back to the board for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Salio. Questions, Mr. Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief, how much have we spent so far in terms of getting us to this point, if the board were to?
Yeah, so far we have $1.9 million in sunk costs. Primarily that's staff costs that have been paid to GSA for the ongoing project management, and then some for architectural services.
And how much?
Placed outside the county. And that fluctuates, obviously.
And so that entire group, the 15 to 18, would be able to be housed here, or what percentage of those would be able to stay?
My guess would be probably close to 80% of those kids would be able to come back. There's some kids in specialized programs like sex offender programs, et cetera, that may not be able to come back, but the bulk of those kids will be able to come back into county.
Okay. And do we there's been a lot of talk about the housing unit and whether or not we mm-hmm. need the extra beds. Mm-hmm. So let's presume that probation continues to do the incredible work that they're doing, and we don't need those beds, mm-hmm. even after we build this.
Mm-hmm.
What can that be used for?
Well, I mean, the beds, we're only going to gain five more beds. So if the population of the juvenile hall kept decreasing and decreasing and decreasing, and the only kids we had at juvenile hall were kids in treatment and none that were in detention, that gives us a lot of different opportunities to use those beds. We could use it for other kinds of treatment programs. We could use it for drug and alcohol treatment. We could even turn it into an outpatient-type treatment. We could turn it into a weekend or a day treatment program where they came in for the day and then left in the evening. So all those things are possible because it's all controlled by the county. So the county can decide how they want to use that facility or that property any way they want to use it. So the part that's owned by the state in the construction, the 20 new beds, that would be used for detention. That's what we told the state we'd be using it for. But the rest of the juvenile hall could be used for many different things. And it's only as matters how creative we want it to be.
So the security issue isn't the same as you would have, for example, within a jail?
No, not at all, because we have different ways of segregating the closing it off and those kind of things. So it's a lot more flexible than the jail would be, yes.
Okay, and then when you talked about the last round, and you mm-hmm. said we beat out Monterey by 1 point,
mm-hmm.
how many projects were in that up for that same competitive round?
In the medium-sized counties, I'm trying to think. I think there was maybe five counties that were in it, and two were funded. When we were one of the two that were funded, because the funding was broken down to large, medium, and small counties.
So five were going through the process, two were funded, mm-hmm. including us. So presumably, whoever didn't get funded in that last cycle are going to apply in this next cycle. Would that be reasonable to assume?
It may be. I know there are counties that are going to apply in this last cycle. From talking to other chief probation officers, they're waiting for that didn't get funded. So I would assume that they may have been counties that weren't funded in the last round, correct?
Okay, and then just can you repeat for me? I make sure I wrote it down right. So the maximum award is $12 million on this round?
Yes, yeah, so I believe it's
the next round of funding from the state was the maximum award was $12.5 million. The minimum award was $3 million, the maximum award was $12.5 million. Okay. They only had $25 million total to draw from.
Okay, so presumably they're going to get probably the same number of applications that they got last time.
I would think so.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Meacher.
Yeah, Chief, I'm going to follow up on Supervisor Ray's point.
the next round of funding, for example, if we were not to do this, somebody else would be able to be one of those five more than likely to get it. So that means that we would still be, I guess we still have the opportunity to go back the next time around.
Well, this next round of funding, if we said to the state that we're not going to do the project and we're going to reapply for the funding, then yes, we would be in the mix with everybody else. How that would work out, I don't know. I mean, it might draw a big red flag saying, you know, San Luis Obispo County, you got money, but now you're not going to do it, kind of thing. And so I think that's something that they look at within the scoring of the applications for the funding, is the county's commitment to do a project as well. So
but they don't pay much attention to the fiscal
conservative
position that we might want to take.
Well, that's true. I mean, you know, we could say we didn't have enough money, but this next round, we don't know how it's going to. They may say, okay, it's, you know, we have 3-4 counties that are applying within the medium county, and we're going to fund two of them. And so, what can you do for $5 million, or what can you do for, you know, $6 million? So there's no guarantee. I mean, from what I'm understanding from the Board of State Community Corrections and the Executive Steering Committee that's working on the application, is that their goal is to try to fund as many projects with this last bit of money as possible, because this is the last bit of money, kind of thing.
Ms. Arnold.
Yes, thank you. So, Chief Salo, you mentioned something during the slideshow, and it was about the liability that the county could incur for not meeting, I guess, education codes by providing classrooms for the students that you're teaching.
Well, the main concern are children with IEPs or individualized educational programs, because they have special requirements within those IEPs that need to be
for youth and adolescents with severe emotional and mental health issues. And in researching that agenda item yesterday, I was told that we just don't have any facilities like that in the county, so those children are being sent to other places. Is there an opportunity, you talked about getting creative, to just partition sections of this building until it's needed for what it was, for what you were asking for?
Right.
So, in other words, we have space that has the potential for alleviating some of these other...
Yeah, I mean, we have a facility that we can house children in.
Okay.
How we want to use that facility would be based upon the county's willingness to use it for whatever it wanted to be used, and also meeting the state requirements for how that facility is supposed to look as far as space size and bedroom size and those kind of things. I'm aware of other juvenile halls in the state of California that are looking at taking existing bed space that they have and turning them into almost like a home-like environment, like a group home-like environment, where the kids would leave there, go to school during the day into the regular community and come back and those kind of things. So everybody's kind of being creative, and I think to Supervisor Ray's point, that we have the ability with that space already there to be as creative as we want to be, to use that any way we choose that's going to be best for the county.
Back to Ms. Ray.
Yeah, I just had one other question I forgot to ask. So if just for sake of understanding the chart that I made myself out of your scoping and budgeting, if we were to go back to rebid and knock out the extra housing unit,
right,
what would you expect in budgetary terms that would change?
Well, so that if we went back and rescoped it and took out the housing, then I do not believe that the state would fund the project. They would say, no, this is not what you said you were going to do, and so you're out of state scope, and we're not going to. So if we went back and said, okay, we're going to design a new project and try to fund it with just county general fund money or whatever, we've been trying to figure out what that cost was going to be, and it's really hard to put a handle on how much is the housing unit alone just breaking out. I don't know if, Tully, if you have...
I don't have it with me, but I could definitely get the information.
Yeah, I mean,
based on the estimate we had,
yeah,
it was underneath the bids we received, though, so we could make a modification there. But you're talking a significant portion of the project. I think if you took the housing part out, you would lose the ability to use the other portion of the building for housing needs that Supervisor Arnold was referencing
Maybe
earlier.
Maybe I'm
also
not being clear on what my question is, because that's not the road I'm going down.
No.
My question is, if we were to go out to rescope this and reapply for the new funding, without that piece of the project, what do you expect a total project cost to be? And I say that because the $13 million goes poof. It doesn't get added into the 25 for the pot for medium-sized counties.
Right.
So if they're going to say, what are you going to do with less money, then potentially speaking, you would have three counties getting $8 million, for example.
Right.
So that's what I'm trying to ferret out, is with a reduced scope and a new round of grant funding, what would a reasonable assumption be there?
So a rough estimate of what you...
Classrooms out in multi-purpose gym. You took out 25% of the cost. That would probably be...
I think that's fair. So if it's 25% of the cost, so, you know, $4,000 to $5,000. Our $45 million toss, that's a deal.
I think I've identified where our math is going.
Hey, $4 to $5 million probably what the, you know, what would take it out. So you figure then we could probably do the project for $11 million.
Okay, and then you would add into that the escalation factors and all of that.
Well, yes, exactly. So we know that, well, we know right now that what we thought was to build what we have right now was a lot more. So it's, you know, it's $21 million right now to build what we have, what we want. So, you know, taking that out.
And the escalation was what, 70,000 per month, right?
60,000 per month.
Okay, so if I take 60,000 and I multiply it times an average of, you said 16 to 18 months, so call it 17 months, that's $1 million right there.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. All right, thank you very much for that. Sorry to...
No, not. We, you know, there's a lot of twists and turns on this, a lot of details and a lot of things to consider. Ms. Arnold?
Well, just if I could take one more minute to look down this to my right to ask Mr. Buckshy, do you believe then that there would be opportunity? I mean, from your looking through your glasses, opportunity to be able to utilize or realize some savings and to the county with the extra space, should it be built the way it was originally designed, that we could use it for other things?
Make sure I understand this correctly. What the plan has been all along when we've talked about this is that the operational cost addition is something we'd certainly have to look at. I mean, I think, from my perspective, the last thing we would want is to spend the additional money and then have space that would be go unutilized. I think we would want to try to find a way to use that, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think right now, you know, come 2016 when we finish the project, I think we would be utilizing all the space. I don't really see it that we don't. It would be something in, you know, if 10 years from now things change or the 5 years from now things change, that might give us more options to use the space differently. I don't think that's going to happen, though, in the fact that, you know, as much as we can drive down juvenile crime and try not to lock up juveniles, there is still a need to have that ability for many different reasons. And I think the county is going to grow, and I think the county, when it grows, the youth population in our county is going to start growing again. It's been declining so much, and I think that's one of the reasons we're seeing it. So I think into the future if we don't move forward with the project today, I think 10 years from now, you're going to have a new chief probation officer sitting here telling you, you know, we got to do something about this juvenile hall. We need more beds. We need classrooms. We need this. I've been in the department 25 years, and I would say 20 of those 25 years we've been talking about how we get more space in the juvenile hall. So it's an ongoing need, and we were so excited when we got this award from the state because we had been unsuccessful so many times before, because it's hard for us to compete with those urban counties that really have a lot of needs. And they look at San Luis Obispo County and say, well, what do you need this for? You know, we were able to convince them that we were going to do this great treatment program, and we had, we were kind of cutting edge pioneers at the time when the 2008 came around. And so, you know, we have this opportunity now that I don't think the county will ever get again to have state money to improve a needed infrastructure in our county. County has to have a juvenile hall, and the better the juvenile hall is, the better off the county is going to be as far as treating juveniles within the county.
And as I pass it over to Mr. Meacham, I have to say that as difficult as this decision is, since we started on this project the year that I took office, we have seen dramatic changes in criminal justice and a significant rethinking of it. It's unfortunate that we have struggled so long with this, but I think as we look forward to the extent that we have an investment in a facility in our youth, properly scoped and carefully executed, I think we're going to find ways to use it. And we can talk about where we go from here. But let me pass it to Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm having a real difficult time with this.
I mean,
it's one of these things where the infrastructure that this county needs is so desperate at this particular point that spending another almost $3 million, could that be spent better someplace else? It's not your fault. I understand that, and I understand the need in a lot of cases. It's just becoming extremely difficult to take an additional amount of money like this and not put it towards water, roads, whatever the case may be, that all of the public would be able to see a benefit from. But so this is a tough one. The other thing that I have a difficult time with is knowing going in some of the reasons that were suggested that why the bids were so high. I'm concerned about cost overruns on this, too. If we start getting into that, where will that money come from? Question two, in regard to the total contract amount, I know the one on the Pataskaro Library only did a 5% contingency. What's on this one?
5%.
It's pretty tight. That's a pretty tight contingency. Just got to let my thoughts out for the moment.
Sure. No, it is. And I think the piece if I was here and saying we want $3 million, you know, to build a juvenile hall, that would be a lot different than saying we want $3 million to leverage $13.1 million. And I think that's the big difference, is that, yeah, it's $3 million that can be used for a lot of different things, but with this $3 million, we get $13.1 million from the state of California, and the state of California doesn't give a lot of money away. So, you know, I mean, it's difficult to take that money and say, you know, we don't want your money.
Ms. Ray?
I'm still kicking this around a little bit, and I am struggling too, but I'm trying to get there.
Mm-hmm.
So based on what my previous question asked, where we could save $4 or $5 million if we went back to rebid, then that puts the cost of doing this alone, with or without an award,
mm-hmm.
At 10 to 12 million ish.
Mm-hmm.
And presumably we get an award. Let's say we get, again, we're guessing, we're just throwing darts, but say we get 8 million, which is a third of that money, of the state's money that's available. So that would mean that we would be in the neighborhood of needing $2 to $4 million more, and we're right back in the same boat we're in right now with a lesser project. So,
right.
So that's the part, again, I'm struggling with. And on top of that, the cost that we're dealing with right now is with already a $2 million investment. So that's without a $2 million design investment, which reduces the scope of a future project even further.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like we're being thrown over a barrel. It has nothing to do with you, mm-hmm. of course, but it's prior decision makers prior to this group. But I'm not sure that I'm struggling too. You know, I've been to the juvenile hall. I sat in the kitchen and saw a classroom sitting in the middle of a kitchen with dirty dishes right next to it.
You
I mean, there is
no.
I was visiting juvenile hall. Tremendous risk of being, you know, again, forgive the metaphor, but being all in on a new project. The risk there is so high. But I'm still frustrated by maybe some improper scoping and some poor engineering and some of the things that have failed us on this and other projects. So I'm kind of all over the place still.
Supervisor Ray, I'm going to open it to the public and see if they can help, but I don't have any requests to speak.
You got one.
I do have one. Oh, I have Mr. Diani. Yes, I'm sorry. I do have one. Mr. Diani?
Good afternoon. I'm Mike Diani, President of Diani Building Corp. Obviously, we're looking for your approval on this project. But here to talk a couple of items. First off, our anticipated total man hours on this project are approximately 84,000. Of that 84,000, at least 70% will be local labor used on this project. Santa Maria and San Luis Obispo County. We are a Santa Maria-based construction firm, but we do a tremendous amount of work in the tri-counties. We do a lot of work in the San Luis Obispo County area right now. We don't have a lot of work in the San Luis Obispo County area, so we want to put our San Luis Obispo County residents, which are over 40% of our own employees that are working down in Santa Barbara County, we'd like to move them back up here. So this would be a great project to be able to do that with. So with that, also on the AGC, the Associated General Contractors of America, did an outlook for labor materials this past May. And they are projecting that in the years of 2014 to 2017, that each year will have a 1 to 3% material increase and a 2.5 to 5% labor increase. What we are seeing right now is we agree with the labor increase per year. We do not agree with the material increase per year. We're seeing larger increases that have started to begin in the last few months. Materials are going 4 to 5% right now and larger. The $60,000 that was quoted to you, if you use this project right now, is probably a minimum per month increase. If you put this same project out, I would say you're looking at least at $60,000 per month, if not more. Those were the two points I wanted to bring up.
Thank you, Mr. Danny. Appreciate it. That was our only request to speak, so I'll close it to the public and bring it back to the board. We can wrestle further with how to proceed. You know, maybe I should see if we could get all the metaphors or similes out of the way. We're over a barrel between a rock and a hard spot, located somewhere between the devil and the deep blue sea. So, yeah, playing poker. Exactly, but. As unpleasant as the choices before us are, I think my own view is that we have to move forward. The problems here, to the extent that we're wrestling with them now, started a long time ago. It was compounded by the worst recession in any of our lifetimes of folks sitting in this room. And working with a complex system that is the state financing of these sorts of projects. In the meantime, the world of criminal justice has changed, a generational level change. And so, if you will remember as well, the scope of this project has also changed. It's also been adapted as we've gone and wrestled with this over the last couple of years. The frills have been cut out. We are down to bare bones from where we started, and it seems to me that the only reasonable direction is to move forward on this. It doesn't do much to look back and worry about what could have been or should have been, woulda, shoulda, coulda. We are where we are right now. We are faced with a juvenile hall that is not adequate for our needs. It is certainly not adequate for our needs in the new world of criminal justice realignment. We have great plans aside from our physical plant for how we want to take care of a number of very deferring projects that the county has contemplated for some time. And the exact projects are in our staff report. There are many worthy ones there. But as I consider how we should dispense our resources, it occurs to me that this extra spending on our youth is what we have to do.
And it really is a matter of looking, to my mind, of looking at the alternatives, none of which appear at all attractive to me, all of which incur their own amount of risk. And so we can grit our teeth here. I think we have to grit our teeth. The problem that we face started a long time ago. But I think that what we have to do is move forward on this. I think in the end, the half of that $3 million, the $1.5 million that we're being asked to fund out of our precious reserves, is going to look like a good investment. We are on the threshold of a new world in criminal justice, and dealing with the youth in the criminal justice system, to me, is an investment that we just have to make. So however unpleasant this appears, every other option that I can contemplate appears worse. So I'm supportive of staff's recommendation. I'll pass it to Ms. Arnold, and we can have deliberation.
Thank you, and I, too, am willing to support option number one. You know, we have this, we've been awarded a large sum of money from the state, and it's just going to cost us a little more than we thought. But if it wasn't something that we really needed, I would be thinking a little longer and harder. You all know how much I talk about putting money into roads, but here I am. I think that this is just something. We have a local experienced contractors here at Downey's, and I think that it's an opportunity if we pass it up that we won't have the chance again. So I, too, am willing to support Steph's recommendation for option one.
Ms. Ray?
Well, and here's where I got to. I think I can support it today, and I want to explain to the public why, and I hope that people are listening, and I hope the newspapers are going to write. Because the best-case scenario, if we don't do this, is we lose $1 million in the grant. So that's the very, very best-case scenario, is we go out to bid, we get the grant, we get the max at 12.5, and we lost $1 million. And on top of that, we still have this, the design that has to go into that. So we get a much lesser project for $1 million, less money leveraged. The risk here in escalation to me is huge. And that's where this board went wrong before we got here. And so to continue to do the same thing and expect a different result, we all know what that's the definition of, right? And lastly, what's kind of put me over the edge here towards saying yes is that if we go back and get a reduced grant, which we will by definition, by it being at least $1 million, we're still going to have matching funds to bring in and whatever else. We're still going to be spending $3 to $4 million there in best case scenario, which is where we are right now, but for a much lesser project. So when you do that math, there's no decision to be made, and I finally got there. Thank you for letting me do this in open session and get there. But once you look at that and say, okay, 12, 16, 2 years down the road, we're still going to spend $3 to $4 million. We're still going to have to make the same adjustments we're making right now, but we're not getting the same level of product out of it. So this is by far the wisest use. And once I got there, I think that's where I'm at. So erring, you know, on a personal side, you err on the side of kids. But on a fiscal side, I think it does bear out if we get through the numbers deep enough.
Mr. Hill.
Yeah, I don't. I guess this is dramatic a decision for me. Most, you know, when we've seen some of these cost overruns on capital projects, I mean, it's always an unpleasant thing. But we have public safety as our leading priority. We have a state mandate to do these things, which is our other leading priority, budgetarily. And I have confidence in Chief Salio and his team. It's something we need to do. It's never fun to spend more money than we had hoped for. But, you know, we spent almost $2 million already. That makes no sense just to walk away from that, you know, from the project we have planned. It's not cutting losses, because we do have a project on the horizon that we'll complete and that we need. So I would make a motion to approve the scenario number one.
Thank you. Do I have a second?
I'll second.
Thank you, Ms. Arnold. I think we've had a very thorough discussion. Mm-hmm. Appreciate your analysis, especially of the options. With that, We'll take a roll call vote.
I'm sorry, I have a question.
Very good.
Frank's.
His speaker is down. My speaker is down. The mothership, I think, is too close to us. I'm not sure. Ms. Berg and Ms. Howard, my, how Public Works has changed. What a pleasure. Look at this. You got the middle-aged guys sitting in the second row. That's great. Yeah, well, it used to be the engineering department, but now it's the it's the 21st century.
With that, good afternoon, Chairman Gibson and members of the board. My name is Courtney Howard. I'm from County Public Works, and by way of introduction of this item today, I just wanted to note that the Integrated Regional Water Management Program has significantly evolved, I believe, since it was first came into fruition in 2002 from Proposition 50. And not only is most of the state actively engaged now, our local water resources stakeholders are actively engaged now. And so I think the county has greatly benefited from our participation, and a lot of that is due to their engagement. And we've definitely improved upon, I believe, our water resources management collaboration. And so that benefit has come to fruition through that and also through grants for our water resources management efforts. And Ms. Carolyn Berg here on my right came on board about 3 or 4 years ago into these water resources planning efforts after helping to get the Nas Manah Water Project up and running. And it came at a good time because the Paso Basin efforts were ramping up and I needed some help to keep that program going. So through her leadership, we've benefited again through grants, and she's here to take us through that journey. I was also impressed with her ability to handle all the curveballs that came along on this journey and updating the plan. Came in the form of an unanticipated grant round, unanticipated new changes to the guidelines for the IRWM program, and an expedited schedule for updating the plan. So I think she all handed it all in stride, and I greatly appreciated that. And with that, I'll let her take you through the journey of the 2014 updated IRWM plan.
Ms. Berg.
All right. Good afternoon, Chairman and Board. Thank you guys so much for having us. We're here today to hold our public hearing to adopt the IRWM plan, and that's consistent with the California Water Code and Government Code that guide the IRWM planning practices throughout the state. So I just wanted to take us really quickly backwards to look at the IRWM program as a whole, and then walk you through the 2-year steps, really, that it took to get our region to this place that it's at today, and then we'll step into today's recommended action. So as you know, back in 2002, California voters passed a series of propositions and a water bond that put the IRWM planning in place for our state. And since then, 49 IRWM regions have been formed throughout the state, San Luis Obispo County region being one of those. And of course, you guys are all well aware, integrated regional water management is really just looking at a new way of managing our water resources collectively with other agencies, and looking outside of our normal benefit areas so that we try to find multi-benefit solutions to big problems in water resources. I also wanted to just point out that, again, this is a planning effort, and it's not regulatory. It's really in place to better manage water throughout California and also make regions throughout the state eligible for grant funding, as we've seen in the past. So as a quick background, in 2005, our region proactively stepped up and formed our own IRWM plan, and then we updated that in 2007. And at this point, we had started looking at water resource strategies that we could put into place throughout the county to address critical needs. And we had some collaboration with other agencies. And the reason that we're updating the plan is that a lot changes over 7 years. We've had a number of water resources projects put into place and programs that have been implemented. We've also had planning studies that help to fill data gaps. We've finished the countywide master water report, and that helped to put an inventory of the water balances throughout the county in place. And then we were also, of course, awarded grant funding, which require that we update our plan to meet the newest state guidelines. We've come a long way. And just as a brief background, we received three major grants. The IRWM planning grant we received helped us to fund the IRWM plan update to meet the current state standards, but it also helped to address some of our major data gaps, including looking into the watershed management planning, which the resource conservation districts led. It also helped us to start salt nutrient management planning in the Paso Basin, which will serve as a template when it is going. So what the state looks to us to do as a region is to update our IRWM plan on a 5-year cycle, and then starting this year, they're starting to evaluate our plans and make sure that we're adhering to their guidelines. And from there, we step into the implementation and monitoring program for this plan. So in looking back, this all really started when your board and other agencies signed onto the IRWM MOU, which established the governance process for the IRWM program. And the reason we looked back and readdressed our governance was to make sure that we were bringing about a better collaborative effort and bringing in more stakeholders and agencies to this process. And after that, we went through the process of bringing on a consultant to help with the plan update, and then spent 2 years basically developing the draft plan itself and then going through the public comment period and submitting this to the state. So we're at the final great stage of adopting the plan. So just looking back at, there's three main critical steps that we took during this process. The first one was establishing the governance, like I said. And what you see here is the graphic I've brought to you several times before. And it just shows up the bottom-up approach of how IRWM planning works and bringing in individual agencies and individuals and communities and trying to bring all of the data and their ideas into one hub of information and planning document. And it filters up through the Regional Water Management Group to your board as the lead agency. This really just allows us to better manage our resources as a whole. And as in June, I believe was when I came, we still have 23 agencies on a Regional Water Management Group. And it includes nonprofits, cities, CSDs, special districts, and your board as lead agency. So we cover a good breadth of types of interest areas in water resources. I think it's important to note that the reason I reiterate that there's 23 agencies is this really could be updated at any time. So if a new city, not new, but City of Atascadero or some other agency wanted to join this group, they could at any time by signing the MOU and adopting the plan that we've just finalized. This group took action on August 6th to approve the plan as it was finalized and to recommend to your board and the other agency boards that they adopt the plan and move forward with its implementation. Another great stakeholder group we have is your Flood Control District's Water Resource Advisory Committee, and this covers a wide array of interest areas throughout the county, and it gives yet another chance for public input into our planning efforts. So they've also been key in moving this plan forward and have helped to support reviewing the documents as they were brought forward. Also on August 6th, the RAC went ahead and recommended that your board adopt this plan. So the second critical step that the IRWM planning takes is setting up the vision and the goals and objectives that really drive the plan forward. And they become the foundation for where we want to see this county go over the next 20 years with our water resource management. So like it says here, with our vision, we're creating a united framework among our stakeholders for sustainable water resource management. And we look at flood management, groundwater management, water supply, ecosystems, and watershed. And then at the center of that, just improving our communication with the public and among our agencies to better manage as a whole. And I'll kind of walk you through how we got there now. So each quarter, wanting to make this as friendly to the public as we could, since it's such an intensive process, we would publish quarterly reports that really look at the milestones that have been achieved, meetings we've had, results of those meetings, and then they also highlight upcoming steps. So we try to keep the public involved and let them know how they can get review different parts of this planning effort. So in the first quarter of 2013, we went through the kickoff process where we hosted 10 workshops and meetings throughout the county and started to engage our stakeholders. We also developed the communications and outreach plan that defined how stakeholders wanted to be involved and how we could engage them best. At that time, we took a big step by getting the public's input on what they felt were the biggest issues throughout the county. And while they gave us many different items, maybe 40 or 50 different things that they thought were important in the county, the top three that continued to come up no matter where we were in the county was water supply, improving our groundwater management, and then also increasing the use of recycled water. So then the next quarter, we continue our public outreach, of course, through a series of meetings. We took the issues that we heard throughout the county, and then we started to develop goals and objectives. How does this actually channel into the IRWM plan, and how do we take issues and make them into solutions? What's our aim? That's really what we did this quarter, and then we start the process of collecting data and information that would be filtered into the plan itself in other sections. And then in the third great step, we were finalizing the plan and compiling all of those draft documents, and we were able to publish the results of that third foundational step with our project review process. And right about that time is when the state released its new guidelines, which were brought on by the emergency drought situation and a release of a change, I guess, to the use of the water bond that had been passed through Prop 84. And so this is where we went right back to that adaptability of our RWM planning effort, and we had to think, how do we want to make sure that we're addressing this new state standard? And so in early 2015, the Regional Water Management Group and our project team went through the process of looking at our plan in relation to the guidelines and really going through with a fine-tooth comb and just checking to see if we really thought that we had included everything that the state would expect to see, and we conducted our own review of the plan so that when we handed it over to them, we could be confident that it would do well with the state's review process. So you can see here, we look at 16 different standards. They're what guide the IRWM planning throughout the state, and the state's really looking to find consistency but still allow local planning to drive the plan forward. This was helpful. Also, what happened at this point, like Courtney had said, we got new, I guess, requirements on the timing of this. Because the drought emergency funding had come about, the state also put forward in about May of this year, they told us that if we wanted to be eligible for grant funding, we needed to submit this plan for their review by July 21st, and then we also needed to submit proof of adoption by all of our agencies no later than September 9th of this year. So it drove our process forward quite quickly, but it has worked out very well. Like I said, we got consensus from the Regional Water Management Group to approve the IRWM plan and recommend your board adopt it today. And we also got the RAC's support for adoption by your board today. So after our discussion and this hearing, we will continue to work with all of the member agencies. And we have targeted that we should have all adoptions in by September 4th. So it's looking like we'll meet all the state deadlines on this front. So in moving forward, once we have this plan in place, we step into the implementation and the monitoring. And I won't get too deep into this, but I did just want to point out that once you adopt the plan, you start to look forward to the next five-year cycle. And rather than leaving everything until the last final step, 4 years from now, we wanted to point out activities to ourselves that we might be able to do over the next 5 years and try to streamline the processes that our county takes and also that the agencies throughout our county take and try to get a better implementation process in place. So while there's a lot of activities, we just pulled out a few to highlight here. These are types of activities that will improve our IRWM planning in general that we as staff could potentially take. And so some of those include just developing more refined study areas for our water balance analysis, making them maybe more closely related to groundwater basins or something along those lines. It's also developing a data management system. So when we talk about IRWM as being a hub of all the water resource information, we want to find a way to manage that data and put it in a logical format so that it's easy to follow over time. And then we also want to look forward in identifying next steps through the watershed management planning. The RCDs took a big step for our county by just inventorying the data for all 25 watersheds throughout the county. And now we just need to look at how and if we're going to move forward on some of the efforts they point out as data gaps. Another big step, and this is critical to RWM planning, is developing the strategy for how do we monitor if we're achieving objectives. It's fine and good to have a plan in place, but how do we see if our region is actually achieving what we intended to? And so that'll take some effort since there are about 40 objectives in the plan or so. But that's something we'll be working on. And then also just in general, we do try to continue engaging with the state and understanding what's happening on a broader level with water resources. I think Mr. Hutchinson had touched on that earlier in your drought discussion. We do just want to stay apprised of impacts of things like the pending groundwater legislation. And so that is something that staff continues to do. And with that, I just wanted to also give a special acknowledgement to our very full room here, but to a lot of people that helped make this plan happen. The state for giving us the grant funding to move this plan and fill some of our data gaps, and also to your board for your continued support and participation over the years. That's been critical. Also to the 23 regional water management group agencies. We have Oceano CSD represented, Cambria CSD, S&T Mutual Water Company, and then, of course, the county and district represented here today. But you approved the resolution adopting the IRWM plan. And I would like to close and open up to any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Berg. Mm-hmm. Tremendous effort here, you can tell by the number of folks that are involved. Questions, Ms. Ray?
Couple things. Of the 23 agencies, when just was it a unanimous vote to adopt?
We had 14 agencies there, so we had 14 yeses in favor of it.
Okay.
Those that were there.
Where's South County Sanitation District in this?
They would be considered an implementation affiliate, which is basically just a group. They're not on the RWMG itself, but they can submit projects to the planning process and be considered for grant funding potentially. Yeah, that's about right. And but they did not sign up to be on the RWMG.
So that was they had to actually, any of these members had to sign up to be part?
Yeah.
They weren't invited necessarily?
We invited through the RAC, we invited all agencies to participate if they wanted to. And then, it was voluntary, and whoever wanted to proactively step up onto the RWMG.
So was the South County Sanitation District invited?
Yes. And I think some of the member agencies are on it.
Yeah, I can see that the member agencies are there, but I'm just curious because I don't see any projects that came out of this, and that's been something that we've talked about in South County. There's nothing here from that.
Yeah, and they certainly could join, and that's why I wanted to highlight that back on the slides, was that at any time an agency or organization, as long as they meet the DWR standards for what is included as a local agency or nonprofit 501c3, they can join the IRWM.
Yeah, I believe they were a participant also in the regional recycled water strategic planning effort, which was one of the five special studies. So that was an agency that was involved in that study because of the opportunity for recycled water with that facility.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you. And following on from Supervisor Ray's question, I mean, what's the effect on the city of Atascadero? It was striking to me that they're not part of this process. What consequence bears to that?
I don't see any consequence necessarily, except that maybe they had less participation in the planning effort itself. But they're part of the RAC, and they do actively engage at the RAC meetings. So I know they've been kept aware through our monthly updates at RAC meetings. But certainly if they were on the RWMG group, it would just bring a new level of awareness to the city. I'm not sure how much they followed along the IRWM process or not, to be honest.
Anyone receiving grant funding needs to adopt the plan. So if they have a project that they would like to pursue IRWM grant funding for, they would need to adopt
the
plan.
Okay, very good. Seeing no other questions from the dais, let me open it to the public. Let me start with Sue Luff speaking for the RAC, followed by Amanda Rice.
Good
Good afternoon. I'm Sue Luft, chair of your Water Resources Advisory Committee. The RAC voted last Wednesday in support of the board's adoption of the 2014 IRWM plan. The vote was 17-0 with one abstention, and that member was part of the IRWM plan project team, so he abstained. The RAC and the ad hoc IRWM subcommittee reviewed the IRWM plan documents at key milestones over the last 2.5 years, and a tremendous amount of input was provided by the RAC and its subcommittee during this process. As your board is aware, the IRWM plan creates a united framework among SLO County stakeholders for sustainable water resource management, and adoption of this plan is a critical step to ensure future grant funding. Our region has been successful in obtaining grants in the past through participation in the IRWM process. I would like to recognize the extraordinary effort of Carolyn Berg in guiding the preparation of this plan. She kept the project on track and ensured that the public had plenty of opportunity for input. Other staff and the consultants on the project also did an impressive job. They provided summary materials that were very easy to read and understand. And so the RAC asks that your board adopt the 2014 IRWM plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Love. Ms. Rice, followed by Bill Garfinkel.
Good afternoon, Chairman Gibson and board and staff. Amanda Rice from Cambria CSD. First thing I want to do is I really want to praise your staff and GEI for the work that they did on this. This was a really good example of how you can involve not only agencies but the public really, really well if you put in the effort to do so. In addition to the hard work that they did to make sure that everybody stayed informed in the public, with the all of a sudden accelerated timeline that was involved, so that you don't ignore what is in there. There's a lot of, it's a fat document, and there's a lot of really good information in there, and I really hope to see it continue to get used. If you don't do that, then there is no purpose to having this document, and I urge you to adopt it. I know our board has it on our agenda next week, and we'll be adopting it. So thank you very much to Carolyn and everybody who worked really hard on this. I think it was an excellent example of what we could be doing. And I just, as a final, I just want to brag on Cambria for a minute. This year, in June, we used 38.59 acre feet. Last year, we used 78 in the same month. Our average is about 60-something. We've really cut back and done a really good job, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to get the grant to provide some backup supply for us. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Rice. Mr. Garfinkel.
Good afternoon, board. My name is William Garfinkel. I'm on the S&T Mutual Board. We have been working on with the earworm. We're a signer of the RMG Management Group since actually its inception back in 2011. Worked with Carolyn for many years, and we went through so many changes, and it seems the state really sets high hurdles and then changes their mind. So it was a difficult process, but she got us through that, and I'm very pleased. This past week, the S&T board did adopt the resolution again, and so we are signatories, and I urge you to pass it and look at this as a favorable step forward for the county.
Thank you, Mr. Garfinkel. That was our last request to speak, so I'll close it to public, bring it back to the board for any further discussion. Again, an epic amount of staff work by a lot of different people well outside our organization as well. Let me just ask counsel, I assume we need two actions on this, and so unless there's other commentary by my colleagues, I'd entertain a motion with us sitting as the flood control district, please.
So moved.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham and Mr. Hill. With that, a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Meacham.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill.
Yes.
Ms. Ray.
Yes.
Ms. Arnold.
Yes.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes. And then back in our usual role as the Board of Supervisors, again, entertain a motion on staff's recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham. Thank you, Mr. Hill. You guys are, once you're on a groove there, you know, we got to keep
the transition's tough.
I understand. I know. And seeing no further discussion, Madam Clerk, another roll call, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Sure.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Again, thank you. A Herculean effort. And we look forward to the ongoing application of this as we address some of the toughest problems we have here. With that, the business before this board is done for the day, and we are adjourned.